The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is Thursday, March the 5th, and let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. The first bill on the agenda today is Senate File 1235. It's being presented by Senator John Marty. I would also like the record to reflect that in the room today are a number of young people who are here for Youth Day on the Hill. And in particular, I'd like to give a recognition to the Minneapolis Youth Congress, who are here to support Senator John Marty and Mayor Artie Rybak in their presentation of the Juvenile Violence Prevention Bill. Senator Marty on Senate File 1235.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 1235 is a bill that came out of the folks in Minneapolis who've been working on this. And the biggest goal here is to try and change the way we address youth violence. Instead of focusing on the criminal aspect of it and hoping that that's going to somehow prevent youth violence, we're trying to do it by investing in the community and engaging young people right away from the beginning. And this legislation is building on that. And the city has worked in four particular neighborhoods, and they'll tell you more about it, but four neighborhoods engaging students at school, engaging them in their homes in the community, bringing everyone together to work on it, addressing at-risk youth, and they feel that this public health approach is having a big impact. And I strongly agree with what they're doing. I think they're having some great results. They had something like a 40% reduction in violent crime in the last several years, and we think a good portion of that is related to these programs they've been working on. So this legislation would simply try and push the state in the direction of working on youth violence prevention, focusing on the types of work that they've been doing under the Minneapolis Blueprint for Action on Youth Violence. And as you can see in the first part, we want to shift the focus more to public health, creating connections between at-risk youth and adults, and intervening as soon as we see signs of trouble, and then helping those who have been engaged in troubled activities and rehabilitating them and getting them engaged. And we define some youth prevention programs, and then basically we realize there's not money available from the state this year, but we'd be asking the Commissioner of Health and a number of other commissioners to work with five neighborhood projects, one from Minneapolis, one from St. Paul, and three from around the state, work with them and try and help provide technical support, help them in getting federal funds and foundation grants. Minneapolis has already received some of them, but I think they may be ending this year. But I think that the success they've had suggests that we ought to be trying to expose the rest of the state to that and move our whole direction in terms of prevention of youth violence instead of waiting till it happens and then using the criminal justice system as the response. And with that, I will turn it over to Mayor Rybak or whoever you want to start.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senator Marty and I are the warm-up act for Taylor and Frederick, who are the stars of the show, as are the young people behind me today. But we very much appreciate you having this hearing. And I think as important it is to think about what's happening here in the Capitol, I want to take you back a couple of years ago to one of the most wrenching moments I certainly had as mayor, and it was the funeral of a young man named Brian Cole. Brian was a good young man from North Minneapolis who, as too often we hear about, was in the wrong place at the wrong time. A bullet took his life, and the funeral I remember so vividly was at Shiloh Temple in Broadway Avenue in North Minneapolis, and sitting on the dais as Brian's casket was in front of me, for more than an hour I watched young people from North Minneapolis one by one file by the casket of their dead young friend. And his parents in the front row, obviously grief-stricken as any of us would be. And I wish that was an isolated incident, but too often I have been in situations like that and so many others as youth violence has really ripped through not only our city and our state, but the country. At that time, after like so many funerals, people stand up and say we have to do things differently, but we really resolved after that we must. And so Chief Dolan and I pulled together mayors and chiefs from around the country and said, what are we seeing here and what's working? And for four chilling hours, mayors and chiefs around the country sat in a room in Washington and told the exact same story. Increasing youth violence, increasing number of young people connected to violence, better access to guns, different values about when to pull the trigger. It added up to something that was both in some ways comforting to know we weren't in it alone and shocking to know how deep the issue was. So we spent time looking around what was really working around the country. And then we looked into ourselves and put together a committee to look at this work. It included input from our young people, including the ones at this table and including the Youth Congress behind us, because our motto is no decision about us without us, and came out with an action plan that had 34 actions under four key guidelines that you see reflected in the bill in front of you today. The first is that every young person needs to be surrounded by a trusted adult. The second is to intervene at the first sign of at-risk behavior. The third is to rejuvenate our kids, and the fourth is to attack the culture of violence. What does that mean? Well, what it adds up to is a public health approach to youth violence. Public health approach doesn't mean that we're simply going to go to violent situations with violent people and try to get them into a hospital. What it says is, like a public health approach, if you're in the emergency room, you bandage up the patient, but eventually you ask, why is the patient here in the first place? So those 34 actions under those four key goals really say a couple things. For instance, in that first one, about every young person surrounded by a trusted adult, it has meant that we have done much more to coordinate the work that we have for supporting our parents, because this all begins with families, for addressing teenage pregnancy, because kids having kids are a recipe for disaster, and unfortunately for violence. It also means doing some very good pioneering work in getting mentoring moving forward. In the second point, about intervening at the first sign of at-risk behavior, one example is that we know that most places you put a kid in a criminal justice system, they don't come out better. But we know that if you arrest a kid for curfew and truancy violations, one of those early gateway crimes, and you connect that to support services, you can prevent them from going deeper into challenges. So our Curfew Truancy Center has had tremendous success by partnering city enforcement, county social services, and together about 80% of the kids never come back. That's a very good thing. We love our kids. We don't want them coming back to the Curfew Truancy Center. That third area of rejuvenating our kids ties very much into what county social services do, but the idea that it's very tough to love a kid who has done a violent act, but it is essential to find a way to get them back in the community and productive and successful. And the fourth is to attack the culture of violence, and we use the word attack. We have to wage peace with our kids. This is not a passive endeavor. And what that is really about is we're launching, with the partnership of the Minneapolis Foundation, a broad-based community outreach and communication strategy that's really about, how do I react when I see a sign of at-risk behavior? What if I see a parent acting in a way they shouldn't with a child? How do I intervene? Those issues are really part of a comprehensive plan. It's been implemented by several remarkable people, one of whom is over my right shoulder, is Brian Schaefer from our police department, who leads our juvenile division, who quietly but incredibly effectively has led this effort on our behalf. The other is Bass Zanjani. Bass, where do I see you there? There you are. Sorry. Bass Zanjani, who is the staff person from our health department on all of this. We don't, by talking about a public health approach, mean to imply that this does not involve tough enforcement. Sadly, we have had to do that. We've done tough things with gangs and many other things. But most of what this has been about is getting upstream. And we are incredibly proud to say that crime is down by more than 20% across the board in Minneapolis, led by a decrease in juvenile crime, led by a decrease in juvenile crime in North Minneapolis by 40%. This is progress. What we ask of you is not money, and I think that's important right now. We know what the situation is at the state. What we ask of you is what we're asking of the federal government, which is to align funding resources and align programs along those four key goals. We've worked with the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the League of Cities. I presented this to Attorney General Eric Holder. And our goal is to have to have plans drafted in our community and communities around the country based on these four goals that then align the resources together, so a person doing a very successful mentoring program will see they're part of that first goal. So somebody doing a program about kids coming out of a correctional institution will see that they're part of this larger whole. So our goal is within a year to have the state have a plan similar to this, have communities around the state have it, and know that they'll be in a partnership with Minneapolis, which is already showing great progress. And with that, I'd like to step back and let the real stars of the show talk, if I could, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And Mr. Mayor, are you aware that the Senate and the House have established a bipartisan bicameral Children and Youth Caucus?
Madam Chair, I am, and I very much appreciate the work that you're doing on that. And I hope as that moves forward, this would be part of the work there. I'd hope at some point, too, I could present the Minneapolis Promise, our work with career centers in high schools and summer job and free college. That's about what the bulk of our young people, the promising, successful stories that we have, is also doing. I think there are a couple of good models coming out of Minneapolis, but I'd love to partner with you and learn with you. Thank you for focusing on where it needs to be.
Well, we will look forward to working with you on that.
Thanks.
Our next testifier is Mr. Frederick Hubala.
Hubala. Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to the committee. Restate your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Frederick Hubala is my name. And as a resident of Minneapolis and a student at Brooklyn Center High School, I've seen my fair share of violence among my fellow young people. And I think it's really important, whether it's seeing the crime scene in the back of my alley or seeing a neighborhood fight, violence is a major issue among young people. And Mayor Ryback and Senator Marty pointed out that a lot of the things that have been put about to help these efforts are really important. And I can tell you from firsthand experience being a young person in these programs and part of this action that they truly do work, and that it is really important that the action be put into place. Firstly, my favorite one is a young person with a caring and trusting adult. I want to say that if it had not been for a caring or trusting adult, I don't know where I would be right now. I'd probably be in the streets up to no good. But I think that the fact that a adult came up to me, approached me, and took me under their wing, that I was able, I mean, I'm not a perfect person or a saint or anything like that, but I do know right from wrong. I do know that I can go to somebody when I'm in help or go to somebody for advice or wisdom. And secondly is intervention. You know, there's a lot of young people that make mistakes, and it's something that's inevitable. And one of the things that I like about some of the programs that I'm a part of and that we do with the organization that I work with is that you don't just punish a young person for making a mistake, but you intervene. So, like for instance, when we ran a program called Piece by Piece in the city of Minneapolis with students at Yo! The Movement, they were referred to us, and we went through them with curriculum from Peace Jam, and we work with these young people, and you show them the skills and the tools that they need to succeed, and I think that that's really beneficial to young people. Like May Ryback said, youth violence decreasing by more than 20%. It's from programs such as that. And then another thing that I like in the action is rejuvenation. I think that once after you intervene that you have to include some type of rejuvenation for these young people. Otherwise, you're just intervening and they're left alone to do nothing. And again, breaking the cycle of violence, highly important, something that young people really need in the city of Minneapolis as well as the whole country. Something that's not done as much as it should be. So to wrap it up, I really feel that the blueprint for action is something that's really needed in the city of Minneapolis as well as the whole state of Minnesota and the country. And youth violence should be addressed as a public health issue. But Taylor could probably say a little bit, as being a Minneapolis resident herself and student.
Sorry.
State your full name for the record.
Okay. My name is Taylor Reed. I'm also a resident in Minneapolis. And I would agree on what Frederick and Mayor Ryback were saying, especially when he was saying his example was after a child has gone into the hospital, gotten patched up, an adult needs to be there to say, why did this happen? What were you involved in? Because after that, a child can be open or a teen can be open to an adult, which is very, very hard. I can say that personally because it took me a long time to open up to some of the adult leaders I am involved with today. Because adults are sometimes it can be stiff or they feel that you can't relate to us. And because of that, we put up these walls. And because these walls are put up, you guys are trying and trying and trying, but it takes a while for us to, say, I trust you. So after that trust barrier is broken, it gives us a say, okay, you're an adult, you have resources, I can go to you for help. Because, and you, plus you guys are older and wiser, so you, we can ask you guys for advice. And also, this violence that's happening in Minneapolis, it happens every day. And seeing that firsthand is something really scary, that a five-year-old, I personally saw a crime scene, and a five-year-old was walking out from school, and she saw it as well, a little girl. And she was just, she kind of looked at it and was like, well, oh well. She didn't really care because she saw it all the time. So with that kind of security around children, teens, even adults, is not very safe. So with these, with this blueprint, I feel it would really help with us in our day-to-day lives, not even if it can spread out to other parts of the country, but even if you help a child, me, that five-year-old child, five-year-old girl, it can really help just there.
So, you know, in with supporting Mayor Ryback, the city of Minneapolis, everyone, from the bottom of our hearts, we hope that you will take heed into these words that we spoke to. This is true. We're both from Minneapolis, raised there. It's some place that I always call home, and I would hate to see the young people coming up as years go on not be helped because good people like yourselves or your colleagues didn't help us by passing this bill to make it a public health issue, or in the future passing bills for it to receive funds for some of the greatest programs and activities that are going on in the city and state to go on. Because seriously, I cannot stress how important it is that at a young age that I was involved in programs and activities throughout the city. And it's not for every young person, but I do feel that if things such as the bill being passed that it made a public health issue can give segue to the program flourishing and more young people thriving in a great state of Minnesota. So
thank you.
That's my two cents.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, if I might, I have to say hello to Frederick. He's a student at Brooklyn Center High School, where I do all the substitute teaching that I do anymore. And he's a shining star in our in that building, and a really good example. This is your senior year, Frederick, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so thank you for coming over here. And Taylor, though, you guys were really articulate, and I appreciate that you did come over to testify. Have you done this before, Frederick?
Not exactly, sort of.
Oh, okay. I thought so. But he's really involved.
But seriously, thank you so much for this opportunity. Not many young people can say that they've had the opportunity to speak to the senators in their state or city. So I'm very grateful. I hope so that more people like yourself remain in office.
Well, Frederick, I hope that the next time you're at the Capitol, perhaps you'll be on this side of the table. Any questions for the mayor or the author and the testifiers? Senator Parasol.
Madam Chair, I just want to commend the people at the witness table, Mayor Ryback and John Marty, and the witnesses. Thank you, both of you, and for all the people who are supporting you, because I think the model has just about all the elements you need to be a successful program. And it's fine to intervene, and as both of you said, you needed somebody to be there after they intervene, because you can't walk away and do it all yourself. And not only that, they'll support you, and they'll refer you, and they'll help you as long as you need it. And that you have police involved in your life, you know, that are still going to patrol your streets, which will keep you safer as well as everybody else. I think that's, but the work element is also a very important element of the program. There has to be some fruition to what you have, and it must be fruitful work, and you must feel that it's worthwhile so that you think it's fruitful. And I see that element as I read this program. I'd like to hear the reports on it as it operates. That'd be great to hear.
Well, members, Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, we do have a little bit of cleanup to do. the legislature is not a fact-finding body, and I don't know whether page 1, lines 8 through 17, are appropriate for the bill. I don't know whether this is true or not, but I would move to delete page okay. 1, line 18 through page 1, line 16.
And Senator Betzel, usually in this committee, I really look forward to this being your prerogative to help us serve the Senate better. But let me suggest this, that this bill is in the committee because we have Youth Day, and there are a number of bills in this committee on youth related. Language. Senator Marty has generously allowed the bill to come to us to be part of our youth agenda so that we can have this testimony about youth violence as a public health issue in this committee. But if you really look at the body of this bill and the substantive content of this bill, it really is a health care bill, I mean, a health policy committee bill. And so as much as I appreciate your motion, Senator Betzel, this bill is on its way to the Health Policy Committee. And if we can get a commitment from Senator Marty that he will make sure that this area that you've raised a concern about, once the Health Policy Committee has had an opportunity to look at it, I'd like them to have a chance to at least read the findings, that Senator Marty will take care to make sure that it is in comportment with what this committee wishes. And if that doesn't happen in the Health Committee, I'm sure once the bill gets to the floor, you will have another opportunity at this, Senator Betzel. And usually I don't make that request of you. I really appreciate the work that you do in this committee, but my sense is that I would like the bill to go intact to the Health Policy Committee for their review.
Madam Chair, I think if Senator Marty wants to, you know, copy what's in that first section, subdivision, he can do so. But I would like then proof that what it says that it leads to a 43% reduction in juvenile violent crime. Where does it say that? If the legislature is going to make a finding such as that, this information is not, you know, is significant. Do we really mean that?
So, Senator Betzel, would you?
Madam Chair, I move that delete sections 1.8 through 1.16.
Any discussions, Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, that's fine. We can make the points we want to make in the committee without it being there. So, I understand.
All right. Thank you. I tried. On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Any further discussions on Senate File 1235, as amended? Senator Scheid, would you like to move the bill?
Madam Chair, yes, I would very much move that Senate File 1235, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Health, Housing, and Family Security.
On that motion, any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Congratulations. Mr. Mayor?
Madam Chair, first off, thank you so much. Would I also just as a ask a favor of members on the committee? You just heard great testimony from two of our young people. Taylor is a junior, so we have a year to work her over. Frederick has been accepted at the University of Minnesota, but he seems to also be applying at colleges in other parts of the country. While we're happy for him to go there, I hope people would take the opportunity to tell Frederick how much, if we want him to be sitting on that side of the table, he'd get a head start by going to the U, but that's a whole other topic.
You know, this is home, and regardless of how far away they go, they'll come back. So, Frederick, go find yourself, but come back home, okay?
Yes. And, Madam Chair, we have many other wonderful Minskew colleges around the rest of the state, too, that you
like
might
want to
consider.
Like in Bemidji. Thank you, Ms. Mayor. Thank you, Senator Marty. Thank you, Taylor and Frederick.
Thank you.
Is Senator Pappas here?
I think she's upstairs.
Huh?
I think she's
upstairs. See her jumping up.
Okay. So why don't we move to Senate File 765?
Is the author here, Madam Chair? Never mind. Just joking. Is the author here?
Yeah, this author is here.
I read it.
Oh, my goodness. San Juan has four bills.
Madam Chair, I would like my testifiers to please come up to the table so we can expedite this. Okay. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to present to you Senate File 765. It is a bill. Actually, there's an author's amendment I would like to have put on the bill to put it into the shape I would like it to be in.
Okay. And do you have a number for that author's
amendment? It's the A1 amendment, I believe.
A1. The members have the A1 amendment?
Yes. Okay. It's in the packet.
Would you like to address that amendment, Senator Moy?
It's technical in nature, and it the line 1.2 is just a technical correction, and then line 1.3 is, I believe, a cross-reference. Right, Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, yes. The amendment's completely technical. The 1.3 just reflects that the statutory section being referred to is no longer being codified.
Senator Moyes moved the A1 amendment to put the amendment in the shape she would like to have it considered. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate 765, as a bill was brought to me by a coalition of organizations who felt that it was important for us to take a serious look at how we address and work with our youth. And I have with me today two testifiers who I'm going to ask them to testify on the bill first, and then I will go through the different elements of the bill. So my first testifier, Madam Chair, is Mr. Jim Backstrom, who is the Dakota County Attorney.
Mr. Backstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Moy, it's a pleasure to be here with you today in reference to this particular bill. You know, I'm here today, I am Jim Backstrom, the Dakota County Attorney. I'm here today speaking on behalf of Dakota County, who has been involved in the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative program. There are three Minnesota counties that have been involved. We're proud to be a part of a collaborative with Hennepin and Ramsey counties as well that have moved forward in connection with this important program. And we've been involved for the last 3.5-4 years in terms of exploring this and implementing it in our communities across the metro area here. It's a very important initiative. It's an initiative that makes a difference in terms of how we address juvenile crime in our communities, and it's important. And I think the key to this bill is that I think the lessons we've learned in the metro area can and should be expanded in an appropriate way statewide, and I think that's what this proposal is all about. And it requires collaboration. Obviously, it's an important part of the process, and it's important to have all of the players at the table as we discuss this, and that's what we set out to do in Dakota County and have implemented a process that includes, by the way, youth representatives on our particular policy-setting organization in our community to address their concerns as well. But we need to get the buy-in from law enforcement on these this proposal, obviously, because we're talking about protecting our communities and keeping our communities safe. But we're trying to do it in a way that is the least intrusive to the juvenile offenders. And it's important that we evaluate those issues very closely, because juvenile detention should be the last resort. It should be used when we need it, when we absolutely need it to protect our communities, protect our public safeties, and protect the offenders themselves. And we need to evaluate that and evaluate those risks accordingly. And that's what the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, which, by the way, has been in place across our nation for the last 15 to 20 years, that's been implemented through the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which has enabled us to start this process in Minnesota and get some grants to work on this particular project. But it's designed to keep youth out of locked detention facilities, if at all possible, by creating alternatives to detention for low-risk offenders, to make sure we evaluate those offenders and evaluate those risks accordingly. In the past, we've used secure detention in not only here in our state but across this country as the initial resort, and as I said, it should be the last resort and used when only when necessary. Through implementing these types of alternatives, we're able to develop community-based alternative programming for our youthful offenders that provide them with access to the counseling they need, the treatment programs they need, the monitoring that they need, the adult mentors that you heard in the last bill that are so important in the lives of kids. Connecting these kids with those opportunities is how we will not only turn their lives around, but keep our community safer and reduce crime in our communities and in our state. And that's what this is all about. We have developed a risk assessment instrument, which is a big part of this bill, encouraging that a risk assessment tool be identified. It's called a RAI for short, R-A-I, but it's a risk assessment instrument that is developed to evaluate the risks of those coming into the facility. And it's so important that we evaluate that on a race-neutral basis. That's another area that this program is working on to address the disproportionate minority contact issues that we all see in our system, and to address that in a proactive way to reduce any racial disparities that might exist. This does cost money. When we detain youth, it costs $311 a day to detain a juvenile approximately in that compared to about $60 a day for alternative programming. So, I mean, it's a big cost savings. Again, it is important that we recognize, and as we discuss this, implementing this on a statewide basis, especially in the financial climate that we unfortunately find ourselves in here in Minnesota and across America, that we've got to make sure that we have the resources available to do these programs. And I would ask you to consider that as you deliberate on moving forward with this bill and not shift all of these costs to the counties, but we need to have a shared response to that. So with that background, in terms of what we've in Dakota County, by the way, because we've implemented a risk assessment instrument and we've reduced significantly our use of our detention facility, we've been able to avoid building a new detention center for juvenile offenders or adding on to our existing one, I should say, you know, to the tune of about a $12 million expense that we've delayed indefinitely now in our community. And we are the third largest county in the state, and we need certainly adequate services and space available. But we've been able to delay that because of this program. And that's what this bill is basically, as I said, to take the experience that we've learned in terms of developing this in our communities in Dakota, Ramsey, and Hennepin, and to share that statewide as we develop these risk assessment tools. I'll turn it over to our next witness at this point.
Our next speaker is Judge Pam Alexander. She's the Director for the Council on Crime and Justice.
Judge Alexander, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here. This is an extremely important bill, and I want to talk to you about a number of things about it. And I also want to give you some just very practical aspects of what you can see differently in your court systems if this bill is adopted. Obviously, the proposal here is to align Minnesota statutes with evidence-based practices that will only allow youth who pose a risk to public safety or a risk for failure to appear to be held in secure detention. I was a juvenile court judge for 8 years. I was a judge overall for 25, but a juvenile court judge for 8 of those years. And during the time that I was a juvenile court judge, there were many days where I would get memos that would say, the detention center is full. We can't put anybody else in there. So you can't send anyone there. So we would run all around to try to figure out what we would do with these young people in the meantime. What we finally started looking at was it forced the judges at that point to look at who we had in the detention center and why. When we started to take a really good, hard look at that through this, through JDAI and some other studies that we did previous to that, we did find that the number of young people we were holding in secure detention really didn't need to be there. And what this bill really is going to do is to show that it will help youth that should be in the detention center to be there, and youths that should not be in the detention center not to be there, and find less restrictive community-based alternatives for these young people. And we also found that kids that were detained actually had poorer outcomes in the long run. So this will also help kids to have a better outcome as they move forward. Research has also indicated that incarceration is a greater predictor of recidivism. And we find that if we do hold and incarcerate kids, they tend to just do worse as we move them through the system. Minnesota is also among 8 states with the greatest disparities between white and minority youth in juvenile custody. It's really at a 5-to-1 ratio. And local and national studies demonstrate minority youth are overrepresented in secure detention facilities, although their crimes and criminal histories are no more serious than those of white youth. What I see the juvenile, the study that we did in Hennepin County along with Ramsey County and Dakota County was absolutely wonderful. We reduced the number of kids that we held in secure detention by 22.3%. And the average annual admission to the detention center fell by almost 20%. We're finding that, and one of the judges called me the other day and said, Judge, for the first time, they do call me occasionally, said, Judge, for the first time, we have a population under 50 in our detention center. That is unheard of in Hennepin County. I said, you know, I don't believe it. I got to come over and see. So I told him, fax me the detention report, which we got every day as judges. And lo and behold, they actually had less than 50 young people in the detention center. And I think that we should all be very happy about that, because the less kids that we have to hold, we're only holding the kids that really need to be held, that are really a risk to public safety, and the kids that should be other places have other places that they can go and get the services that they need. We're hoping that with the positive public safety outcome, that if we can spend less money on secure detention, then we can have alternatives in the community that will really help kids as they move forward. In the kind of programming that you heard the young people talk about right before us when we got up here, in the kinds of things that we can do to reinvest in our youth so that they're not just sitting in jails. And believe me, juvenile detention is jail. It's not anything any different than that, even though we have cuter names for it. That's exactly what it is, and that always has an adverse effect on children. And the cost savings is substantial. And that is in these economic times, is much, much better. $311 per day to keep a child detained as opposed to $60 in an alternative placement is community-based placement would be much better. In Hennepin County, we do have a juvenile assessment center now. We use the RAE all the time. The kids go there, get assessed, and then can be placed all around. I think overall the cost to the state and to the counties will be minuscule over time because we'll have to detain children less and less. I think that this is a wonderful start to how we can actually better serve our children, and I think that I'm hopeful that it is something that you will give very, very serious consideration to. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions? Senator Pariseau?
Madam Chair, Senator Moi, or anybody at the table, and especially Mr. Backstrom, who talked about the RAI, where and by whom would the RAI be used? Is there a specified point of how this one will be applied to the person who you're determining how to treat or where?
Well, the juvenile assessments tool, we hope to have everybody across the state use it. Very similar to the bail reform tool that Hennepin County actually started many years ago that everybody kind of picked up over the state that we're actually now redoing. But it's a tool that we think we would like everybody across the state to use.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is rather almost an inelegant way of presenting a bill. And and it is not my preference, but I felt that it was important for us to hear from our two testifiers to make the case about how important this bill is. The guts of this bill is to create the risk assessment instrument. But really the bulk of the bill is, and that's not the hard part about the bill, because our Commissioner of Corrections have already made a commitment that it is a doable task to create this risk assessment tool. We also have the various JDI counties who have been experiencing how useful and productive this tool is. But you've also heard previously in this committee that the JDI effort, or the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative, is actually a pilot program that is being funded not with state or public dollars, but through foundation, through the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
That's correct.
And we found that to be very valuable. What this bill is asking is that we work with the commissioner to develop the risk assessment tool that we already know that works, and so that won't be difficult to do. What is difficult under these current climate is how do we take this to scale throughout the state of Minnesota? And as the projects have been in implementation in these JDI counties, we have heard from other counties throughout the state that they like different aspects of the JDAI model. And if not all of it, they would like an opportunity to adopt different aspects of it. So the reason why I'm doing this bill is to create an opportunity for you all to hear from our frontline people the value of something like this. We've seen an implementation. It works. Unfortunately, under these economic climate, it is difficult to think that somehow we will find the appropriations to give to the counties who need the kind of money that these counties have used in order to implement this. Not to mention the fact that we are now 1 year into, is it 1 or 2 years into the JDI implementation? We're in year two. And at some future point, the foundation dollars will end. But I hope that before that happens, we will have an opportunity to bring this back to this committee to have a conversation about how critical it is and how much we need to move forward to really bring this project up to full scale in the state. So we're doing the testimony today, and I wanted to take advantage of Youth Day on the Hill to bring this information to you, but I'm going to lay the bill on the table and keep it in the committee for our consideration and for you to help me think through this project, because I think that it is a great bill. It is good public policy. Unfortunately, I don't think that we're going to be able to identify the kind of resources that we need to move it forward. If the committee should feel that this is something that is desirable, and in working with our advocates, that there's a modified form of it that we can move forward, the bill would be in the committee until the policy deadline, and we certainly could move on a modified form of it. But I just don't think that it is the responsible thing today to move forward with the whole package, knowing that I don't think there's any way we can fund the bringing to scale. So I see the disappointment in your faces. It is very comforting to me, and I'm going to continue to work with the advocates to see if we can scale, you know, do something with the bill in a format that will be helpful. So thank you.
Well, I believe Senator Moaz made a non-debatable motion to lay the bill.
She can just lay it over.
You just laid it over?
Yes.
Madam Chair. Okay. Well, since she's just asking to lay it over, then I think Senator Ortman had a comment she wanted to make. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now I have two. the first was really a question. I wanted to know, is there an age maximum or minimum with one of these children that might be held in custody? Is there an age requirement so that somebody who's four isn't taken away or considered for? I mean, I don't know what the age requirement is. So when you have a child in this bill, what's the age requirement?
It's we don't hold children, generally we do not hold children under 10 in the detention facility.
Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair and Senators, it's very rare that there's anybody under the age of 14 or 15 that is in a detention center.
Okay.
Well, that's not quite true in Anna McKenna. We've had children as young as 12.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think that given some of the other conversations we've had in this committee, it's nice to know where that fits in. And I'm pleased to know that we don't have really young children in custody. I just can't imagine any circumstances where that would be good for anybody. But my other comment after you spoke, Senator Moore, is that I didn't see a fiscal note here. I know that that might be an issue. It would not be an issue with me in getting my support for what you're doing. I think that it's absolutely imperative that we do it and we find a way to fund it. One of the things that I would consider would be perhaps putting some language on the bill that says that it won't be a mandate without funding. And you could put something on that, you know, definitely directed counties that this tool is out here, that this is where we're heading, that maybe this is voluntary if we can't find the funding. And I haven't seen a fiscal note. You did not mention how much it would cost, but I think this committee could consider that in light of the policy to kind of weigh some of the advantages and disadvantages. There are some programs we absolutely should fund and find a way to fund them, and I support you in your effort in doing that, and I will help you find a way to fund it.
Well, Senator Bois, did you have a comment or a response?
Well, Madam Chair and members, the bill is in the committee. You've heard the testimony. You've seen the language. And part of the reason why I wanted to do the bill today is to give you all an opportunity to weigh in. I feel very strongly about this bill. But at the same time, I'm also very conscious of our ability to achieve it in a scalable manner. And the bill is in the committee. And to the degree that you all are as supportive of this bill as I am, we certainly could bring it back at some future date, perhaps with a collective effort on our part to change the language of the bill to make it work. And I would love to have this bill move forward.
Senator Shine. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as we go forward, Senator Moore, I agree. This is a very important bill. And we are looking at just, you know, terrible circumstances in terms of the economy and in terms of the state's budget. And I hope that as much as we're looking forward to making Minnesota a good place for business, that we give equal, if not greater, weight to making Minnesota a great place to be a kid. And not only do we do something here that I think is extremely appropriate, trying to avoid juvenile detention, but also investing in things that keep kids from being in this situation in the first place. And there's nothing more important to the future because the kids are. And so I, Senator Moore, I like this bill a lot.
Senator Moore, I would just echo what you've been hearing, and I would say that actually, Senator Ortman may have a very good suggestion because it could, sometimes we can set a policy direction, even if we can't necessarily fund it now, but if we can make it optional, there may be foundation money or other money that a county would choose to seek. If we're setting the direction at a state level that we'd like to see people moving, you know, maybe that's something, maybe that's as much as we could do this year, but it would still be a step in the right direction from my point of view.
Well, thank you. So on that enthusiastic endorsement, I look forward to getting input and feedback. And, you know, part of the reason with having a hearing like this is that we can hear from people who are interested and want to support the bill. And we will definitely bring it back up before deadline. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dill, I think, is next.
Madam Chair, Senator Dill is here, so I'd like to give him a chance to present his bill, and I'll finish the rest of my bills.
Okay, Senator Dill, I think, is here now with Senate File 1228. Senator Dill, welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Before you is Senate File 1228, which is a bill that I've been working on for two or three years. Senator Moore and I started working on it a couple of years ago. And the reason it's here is because I've grown very concerned with some of the problems that some of our young people get into when they become engaged in sexual activities with somebody that's more than 24 months younger than themselves. And there are places where they wind up almost destroying their lives, not being able to get jobs. They've got registered sex offenders. And it just, in my mind, there's clearly a problem with this. Now, Mr. Ken Bach has helped put this language together 2 years ago, and it's pretty much the same as it was 2 years ago, except for one addition. But I'm going to have him explain the bill since he can do a better job of it than I. But in a nutshell, what this bill does is it gives the judges more discretion in deciding how to manage these young people that get themselves in this trap where they have a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. The girl is often 15, the guy is 17. And when the birthdays come, if the guy turns 18 before the girl turns 16, and they're still in a sexual relationship, it's statutory rape. And it results in all kinds of hardship and trauma for the families. And I think the punishment and what happens to these young people is completely inappropriate. And before I have Mr. Bacchus explain the details of the bill, I'd like to draw your attention to a handout that I have provided you. This is a set of four editorials that the editor of the McLeod County Chronicle in Glencoe wrote about his son's situation, where his son became involved with a girl 2 years and 2 weeks younger than he was. And, of course, he turned 18 before she turned 16. And it's a story here that you don't have time to read right now, but it's a story I'd ask you to look at later. And it talks about the tremendous trauma that was involved when the police came and arrested this young man for this terrible crime, which I don't consider that terrible. Threw him in jail on a Friday night. He had to spend the weekend in jail because the court wasn't in session. And the next Monday, when the court was back in session, he was led into the courtroom in handcuffs and leg irons with his orange jail uniform on, and it was very traumatic. And then he became a registered sex offender, and all the problems was getting jobs, and the psychic trauma involved with this is just horrendous. So I'm going to ask you to take a look at this when you have some extra time, which we don't have a lot of right now. But as a first witness, and before I actually get into the description of the bill, I would like to have Lynn Schauer tell her story. She's a nurse from Glencoe and has a similar story that involved her son. Her husband's a carpenter that builds homes in the Glencoe area, and her son works with him. So I'd like to ask Lynn to tell her story, and then we'll get into the details of this bill.
Senator Dill, we had planned to have Mr. Bacchus give an overview of the context, but if you would prefer, we could hear the story, and then I'll have Mr. Bacchus give the context, and then we'll go right into the language of the bill. Is that your preference?
Either way is fine with me, but Madam Chair, if you prefer Mr. Bacchus to do this bill summary first, that would be fine.
Will your testifier be talking about elements of the bill, or would you just be sharing a story with us?
She'll be sharing the story.
Well, let's hear your story then.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lynn Schauer. I am from Glencoe. I am a registered nurse, and I want to tell you a story that has changed our family for years. When my son was in high school, when he was 17, he started dating a girl who was 15. He turned 18 before she turned 16, the same as Rich Glennie's son. In July 4th weekend, this girl broke up with my son, and he was devastated. August 17th was his birthday. He went to school the following year. We were never told that he had been interviewed by the police department at school. All of a sudden, I picked up the mail one day, and he had been charged with criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree. And, of course, they just used the girl's initials, but I knew who the girl was, and I went and talked to her mom, and I said, "What is this all about?" She goes, "I haven't got a clue." She called her daughter down. She goes, "What's going on here?" She goes, "Oh, that thing." She said, "I just got mad at Jeremy in school one day because he wouldn't change his story about me wrecking another person's truck, and I told him, if you don't change my story, I'm simply going to say we had sex." Well, she said that in front of the high school counselor, who brought them both into the office. And it is very much a she says, he says, we did whatever situation. There is never any physical exam done of the girl. She doesn't have to give dates, times, places, nothing. Before we knew what happened, he had court appearances lined up. We went to talk to a county attorney, and we were told he was facing a 15-year prison sentence for this. I said, now, wait a minute. I said, they dated. He said, that doesn't make any difference. And he was about 21 days over the limit in the age factor. When this got back to the schools, we were called in for a conference, and they asked that Jeremy take an alternative out of the building program. He was a senior. She was a sophomore. He had to leave his school in his senior year, drop all of his extracurricular activities, and be gone. That was what this, and you will read in this story from Rich about this high school counselor and what happened with him. That is the same high school counselor that decided that Jeremy should no longer be in the Glencoe Public School System. He could attend graduation if he did this alternative program. At the time, my world was spinning completely out of control. First of all, Jeremy had been treated for years for attention deficit deprivation syndrome. He'd been on medication. He'd been seen by psychologists. He had many, many tests to prove that his maturity level was not his age level. This girl, at the age of 15, would have passed for 20 in any, or 21 in any given setting. We get into the court system, and we decide that this is not going to, he's going to end up getting shipped off the way, I mean, we can't get 5 minutes with a county attorney to talk to anybody or somebody that's supposed to be appointed to him, so we hire a lawyer. We get a lawyer from downtown Minneapolis. We find out a lot of things. We find out that in the background of this law, the county attorney could be in trouble, or it's kind of a double-edged sword. He should be prosecuting all these cases that come to his table, but that isn't always the case in all counties across the state of Minnesota. We were talked into an offered plea, guaranteed, almost in writing. Mike Young sat at that table and said he will not have to register. He will not have a felony on his record. He will have a couple years of probation, some community service, and this will all go away. I want to tell you that didn't even start to happen. Within 6 weeks, we got a letter saying how he had to start registering every year. He'd started trying to apply for post-graduation schools. He tried to get jobs. The felony showed up on every place that did any kind of a background check. There is absolutely no education offered in the Glencoe school system, and I don't believe in all of McLeod County, at least at that present time, telling young men what could happen. And the actual definition of the charge that Jeremy had was touching or kissing someone more than 24 months younger than him. Mike Young at one point talked to us and said, my grandpa and grandmother would have been in trouble for this. They're 5 years apart, and they got married at the age of 21 and dated for some time. I have some real serious concerns about why just the male is looked at this when it is, and not the female, when it is a relationship. I don't know if they had physical intercourse. I do know that they held hands. I know that he didn't grab her hand. I know that she put her arm around him. If that doesn't say consensual relationship, I don't know what else would. I think the Alford plea is very misrepresenting. You either admit to something that you didn't do because you think a jury may not believe your story, or you face 15 years in prison. What kind of a choice is that for an 18-year-old trying to start his life? It is no choice. Going through this whole procedure probably entailed, I don't know, I honestly went to counseling to try and forget this whole thing several times, but I think we are in the neighborhood of $15,000. I can't tell you how much frustration, I can't tell you how much stress it went through, I can't tell you how difficult it was to go to your boss and say, I know I don't have any more vacation, but I have to be in court with my son because he has this horrible charge hanging over him. During year 9, my son got married and moved to town. Same address, same city address, same zip code, different house number. Lo and behold, Mike Young figured that out and charged him with failure to change his address 30 days prior to moving to town. another $10,000 lawyer fee, another year and a half of probation, 10 nights in jail. And then now he registers for an additional 10 years. Now he doesn't just register. The Glencoe City Police Department comes to his residence every month, 12 months out of the year, with their squad car, and takes his picture, front and side profile. When this second thing all happened, it was about a year after his marriage, and when it was coming to a head, and they had planned a delayed honeymoon, they had to cancel their honeymoon. This second issue, along with a few other issues, caused so much stress in their relationship, their marriage did not last 3 years. Our family dynamics has changed dramatically. I have a son that is 6 years younger than Matt, five and a half years younger than Matt. There is, for at least 6 years, was virtually no brother-to-brother relationship. All of Jeremy's friends knew this was bogus. All of Matt's friends pointed at Matt and said, look at who you are. Look what your brother's been charged with. Matt quit all of sports. Matt never went out for band anymore, never did anything anymore. Matt and Jeremy never got to go to Canada fishing together because Jeremy couldn't leave the country. Matt and Jeremy never got to go hunting together because our guns that have been in my dad's family for years had to be stored at a neighbor's house because we couldn't have the guns stored in our home. My husband who was a very quiet person to begin with, became so depressed he couldn't function with our own business. Jeremy had decreased self-esteem. I'd say no self-esteem. This child had never had one traffic violation. He had never been pulled into school detention. Nothing. All of a sudden, he totals a car, gets a minor consumption. His life fell apart. He had nothing. He said, why should I try to be good, Mom? He said, they are at every corner, every station, every time I turn around, they're there. He said, I was a passenger in a car that got totaled, and I was the first one that got hauled in to be interviewed. Depression ranked high. I honestly put my own son on a 72-hour hold because he was suicidal. My stress level became so high, my physical health went. I developed irritable bowel syndrome. I developed high blood pressure. I had a breast mass that had been monitored since I had nursed Matthew, my youngest son. That was fine. And it, within 2 years of this, turned into a malignancy that had spread to my other breast. I have had bilateral mastectomies. 6 months later, I had a total hysterectomy because I had precancerous cells. I was completely healthy before all this happened. We own a very small business in a very small town. This type of story is on the front page of both papers. How do you think a business survives that? It doesn't. It is difficult. We have now started to come back, and of course now we're in an economic crunch that is unbelievable. Between the lawyer bills for the first incident and helping our son with the second incident, we now, at the age of 58 and 54, owe more money with nothing to show for it than we ever have had in our life. And it's scary. And it's primarily because we took out home equity loan and kept mounting it up to try and help our son. We have had no family vacations for over 5 years when this was going on. We do not have fun holidays during that time. It has been almost 16 years. Jeremy and Matt still need to be encouraged to get along for family holidays and stop blaming. Matt extremely blames Jeremy for bringing a lot of emotional and financial stress to our family. And Jeremy has done everything he can to try and make it up to Matt. My daughter has become the pacifier, and I've tried to become the person that smiles a lot. And it's not a lot of fun, and it hasn't been a lot of fun. And it was because he held hands and kissed a girl. It's ridiculous. I have had someone along the way tell us, and I honestly don't remember if it was a lawyer or if it was a friend who had gone through this and had heard this from his law counsel. They have told Jeremy that he, if he ever chooses to have children, he had better never, ever even consider disciplining them. He better not hug them in public. He better not kiss them in public. He better not look at them in anything that could be in anyone else's opinion wrong, because they will open the whole can of worms again. Jeremy has gone to the same church his entire life. Now that he's married, he is remarried. He's trying to get more established in the community. He decided he would try and help the church by serving on a board. And one of the deacons of the church visited with him and said, you know, Jeremy, all that publicity, I know it went away and then it came back when you moved to town, and we just don't feel this is the right time for you to serve our church. How long does he have to pay for this? How long and why? I don't get it. He doesn't even attend church after that. He went through parochial school. This has stripped our family of years of happiness we should have had. It has stripped two brothers of a relationship I don't think they'll ever have. I don't know. There's got to be a better answer. There has to be a better answer.
Well, Ms. Schauer, thank you for coming to share your story with us. I can see how difficult this is for you to have to retell the whole story. But I have to tell you that you are the most articulate person on this issue, and you certainly are not alone in the experiences that you've had with your child. I think there are people in this room who have had the same experience, and you've been a wonderful voice to articulate the experiences that they've had, similar to you. And this is why the bill is before us, so that we can have a chance to really discuss the issue. And it's not just limited to Minnesota, but it's a national conversation that has been taking place. And that's why Senator Dill has felt that it is the right time to bring the bill forward. So thank you for coming, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
You're very welcome.
Members, the Senate File 1228, as you can see, it's very compelling, and Senator Dill has been working on this bill for a couple of years. But it does create some substantive or a substantive change in direction in our law. And so to give us a better opportunity to put the direction of the bill, the proposed changes in this bill language in the proper context, I've asked Mr. Backus to do an overview of what current law is, and then to brief us on the proposed changes that are contained in this bill. Mr. Backus.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm going to try to give you a relatively quick overview of criminal sexual conduct laws in Minnesota as they currently stand. First off, Minnesota has basically five categories of criminal sexual conduct laws, first degree down to fifth degree. And there's another crime, which is criminal sexual predatory conduct, which was enacted in 2005, but that's really not relevant here. These sections are codified in Minnesota statutes, section 609.342 to 609.3453. And each degree, first through fifth, crime sex, carries a variety of behavior it covers. And first degree, as you can imagine, is generally the most serious penalties. That's a 30-year statutory maximum sentence. And then it goes all the way down to fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct, which is a gross misdemeanor offense for a first-time offense. Now, first-degree and third-degree offenses generally are penetration offenses. Second-degree, fourth-degree, and fifth-degree offenses are sexual contact offenses. Now, the elements of criminal sexual conduct are going to vary widely within each element, but first and second degree are, you know, the more serious ones, basically. It's conduct that either involves personal injury to the victim or the likelihood of that, the use or threatened use of force, violence, a dangerous weapon, or victims who are extremely young. Sexual conduct in the third, fourth, and fifth degree typically address less aggravated conduct, situations where the victim either didn't consent or was relatively young but not extremely young or was incapable of voluntarily consenting to the sexual conduct due to either particular vulnerability or due to the special relationship between the parties. Now, Minnesota law doesn't use the term statutory rape. However, we do have the concept in law. For purposes of that, we basically distinguish two age groups of the victim. Victims under 13, and then victims who are at least 13 but less than 16. 16 is generally the age of consent in Minnesota unless the offender either has a position of authority over the victim or there's a significant relationship, like a familial relationship. But in all of the situations, basically 16, again, is the age of consent. So when the victim is under 13, that's always going to be a crime, and it's going to be either first or well, it depends on how old the age differential is between the offender and the victim. If the offender is more than 36 months older than the victim, then it's either going to be first degree or it's going to be second degree, and it's going to depend on whether it's penetration or contact. If the offender is no more than 36 months older, so the age difference is less, it's either going to be third degree or fourth degree. Now, for the particular, none of this really matters that much for this particular bill. This bill focuses on older victims. Third-degree criminal sexual conduct and fourth-degree address that. It's situations where the victim is at least 13 but no more than 16. And for the penetration offense for third degree, the offender would have to be more than 24 months older than the victim. If the offender is less than 24 months older, it wouldn't be a crime. Now, if the offender is more than 24 months older but no more than 48 months older, it's a 5-year felony. If the offender is more than 48 months older, then it's a 15-year felony. So there's kind of a distinction within the crime. However, as a practical matter, I think they're both severity level D offenses under the sentencing guidelines, so I think they'd be treated fairly similarly anyway. And that's really what this bill is all about. But there is a fourth degree crime that's somewhat similar to this. It's contact, and it's where the victim, again, is at least 13 but less than 16, and here the offender has to be at least 48 months older. Now, that would be a 10-year felony. Now, regardless of whether it's and consent is not a defense here. It's the law presumes that a young victim cannot consent. Now, regardless of whether it's a statutory rape case or a violent rape case, if it's first through fourth degree, it's a predatory offender type case. You'd have to register. Fifth degree, you don't have to register unless it's a repeat violation, unless you get a felony violation. Madam Chair, should I talk about the bill then?
Yes.
Do you have any questions on that first?
Any questions on that? Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, does the predator, the person being charged, have to be at least 18 for this to kick in, or could this be a 16-year-old and a...
Yeah.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, it could be either, as long as if the elements of the crime are present, it could be an underage offender as well. And under Minnesota law, you don't need to be an adult to have to register as a predatory offender. If you're adjudicated of the offense, you'll have to register as well.
Ms. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, then what the bill does, I mean, the big picture thing, what it does is it authorizes stays of adjudication in certain cases involving that third-degree criminal sexual conduct statutory rape case that I told you about with a victim who's at least 13 but no more than 16. So Section 1 of the bill, this basically adds a cross-reference to the data classification later on in the bill. So that's kind of conforming change. Section 2 provides that the law involving sex ed in schools has to include information on criminal sexual conduct laws, specifically those relating to the ages of the victim of the parties. Section 3 provides an exception for the predatory offender registration law for people who are getting the stay of adjudication under the bill. So they wouldn't have to register as long as they successfully complete the probationary period. Section 5 adds a cross-reference to this new stay of adjudication in the law addressing that, and it corrects an incorrect stay of adjudication reference relating to non-supportive spouses and children. Section 5, then, is really the meat of the bill. Subdivision 1 basically talks about who would be eligible for what we call, in this case, we call it a discharge and dismissal, but it's basically a stay of adjudication. The person couldn't have been previously convicted or adjudicated delinquent for a sex offense. Couldn't have been previously participated in a diversion program for one of those offenses or placed on probation without a judgment of guilty for one of those offenses. Beginning on line 4.5, the court would have to determine that the offender couldn't be more than 60 months older than the complainant. that the conduct between the two are essentially consensual but for the ages of the party, that the offender doesn't pose a threat to the complainant or the public, that the actions weren't predatory, and then doing so is in the interest of justice. And then the judge is authorized to consider factors such as the nature and length of the relationship between the parties, the views of the victim's family, the offender's family, the views of community members, and then cultural traditions of the parties. Subdivision 2 there provides that the court, after a trial or upon a plea of guilty, without entering judgment of guilty and with the consent of the offender, put further proceedings on hold and basically place the person on probation upon reasonable conditions that it would require. Under Subdivision 3, if the offender violates a condition of the probation, then the court would enter adjudication of guilt and proceed as otherwise provided in the law. Subdivision 4 authorizes the court to dismiss the proceedings and discharge a person for probation early if it sees fit. Subdivision 5 addresses the record that will result from this. It's a considered a not public criminal record, and it's based on law we have for stays of adjudication in low-level drug offenses and then the non-supportive spouse and children crime. Subdivision 6 provides that a person who's already been convicted of this crime could apply to the court essentially to get this treatment and then would be able to get an expungement under the expungement law. And then finally, Subdivision 7 provides that if a court-ordered sex offender assessment recommends this, that if the person's eligible for a discharge and dismissal under this new law, that the judge could just outright dismiss the case. It doesn't have to do that, but they could. That's it, Madam Chair.
Any questions to Mr. Backus on the bill? Senator Dill, do you have other witnesses? I believe... Should we start with Mr. Engelston, or any comments, Senator Dill?
Madam Chair, members, I was just informed that Michelle Sneed Engelston would like to speak first.
All right. Bye. Welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record.
My name is Michelle Schmidt Engelston.
Please proceed.
I'm a licensed psychologist. I have been for about the last 10 years. I've worked with adolescent juvenile offenders for about the last 25 years. I currently am the program director for a long-term residential sex offender program in Hennepin County, but I'm also a private psychologist, and I've been doing what is described as psychosexual assessments for about the last 4 years in McLeod County. I met with Senator Dill and some probation officers and Scott Eggleston, who happens to be my husband here as well today. have you noticed the last names are the same? Yeah, we both worked in the same field for a lengthy period of time. I've been working with sex offenders for a fairly long period of time. I did it early in my career, took a break for a while, had kids, and now I've been back for about the last 4 years running a residential program. Part of my reason for being here today is that in doing psychosexuals for McLeod County and for other counties, I've encountered this particular issue or concern, I can't say it several times, but a number of times. And have had spent some time trying to educate the county attorney, the public defenders, the families around how this particular situation is unique and different versus a young man or, in some cases, young woman who's coming into the court system who has actually committed an offense that is much more of an exploitive, manipulative, and what people would describe as more of a predatory type of behavior. Sadly, this group of youth that come in oftentimes are charged with a fairly serious level. They may be charged with a third degree, which is a felony. That in our, as Mr. Baca said, it's a fairly serious charge. It goes on their record. They are required to register in a smaller rural county, which is a little bit different than I would say in Hennepin County. Everybody in that community knows that's happening. I think these youth find it really difficult to get jobs, be accepted as, I'm sorry, I forget her first name, as Lynn had described earlier. It becomes a process where these kids are really quickly alienated from the community and labeled quite relatively quickly as sex offenders. And I particularly like that label, but it does define that the behavior that youth do that offend against other is the intent is for harm to occur. And I work with some really high-risk kids, so I have a lot of experience talking with kids who have really cause quite a bit of harm in a sexual way to either children or peers of their own age. The difficulty, I think, in this case is that looking at the reasons for why the two adolescents would be involved. And my job is oftentimes to get information, particularly from the young man who's being charged, to find out if it's a long-term relationship. Have the parents been knowledgeable? Is the relationships, you know, I mean, there have been cases where the young woman has been pregnant. They've already had they've already anticipated that they were going to marry as they got done with high school. That it really has been established in their families as a relationship that parents are agreeable to or sanction. And it comes into the court system generally because it gets some conversation gets discussed in school. To be honest with you, I think that's oftentimes where that information comes. You may have a counselor or a teacher overhears that information, begins to question it, and then it becomes a mandated report, and then it becomes part of the court system. My thought is that the current approach to working with adolescents who sexually harm are becoming more and more restrictive. I have young men who are 15 who are obligated to register for the next 10 to 15 years of their life. Now, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, but I do agree that they've made some really bad choices and harmed people in such a way that we need to have them be accountable. This particular group of adolescents, or youth as you want to call it, one, I don't see that their behavior, the intent is to harm. The other is, I don't know that they need long-term repercussions as a result of being involved in a relationship, at least what most people would consider to be consensual. Part of my reason for being here today, I guess, is to give you either to answer some questions or to give you some ideas of why I think this law, this bill is being proposed. I think in part is to begin to look at these youth a little differently, to allow the court system to have some discretion to look into the situation. What may appear on the surface as the behavior, there may be a lot more information they need to get gathered. That tends to be my role oftentimes, which is to try to gather enough information to help the court make a good decision and to help the county attorney look at, do we charge this young man? Do we stay their adjudication? Do we put them in an education program? Do we provide any treatment at all? What's the best approach to, in my mind, at least educate these youth around why they're now in the court system and to help them understand it? I think, as Lynn said earlier, I was thinking back. About 2.5 years ago, I had a situation with an adolescent girl who I did an evaluation with, who was 2 years and about 2 months older than the young man she was dating. No sexual intercourse. I think they kissed and they touched. Got involved in school, did an evaluation with this girl, and she ended up getting charged with fourth degree. It was a really unique situation. This child was just completely alienated from her community. I mean, I'm fairly sure the family moved shortly after that. But it was really fairly unique for an adolescent girl, but it also was about this age, and there was a lot of people who had a judgment and a reaction. So it isn't just typically young men that occurs. But they look at that behavior, which is, okay, these two youth are, you know, years apart or far enough apart that they shouldn't be have some sort of sexual contact with each other. So we need to respond in a legal way. And we need to hold them accountable in a legal way. I'm not certain that that's always the best way to respond. And I also would like to say that I tend to really support the idea of all kids who come into the court system who have come in under some offense that's related to sexually harming someone else, that these young men and women need to go through some type of an assessment. And at least what the assessment allows us to do is to gather some background information. I interview the parents, I interview the adolescent, I talk to the probation officers. If I need to, I get information from social services. I gather enough information so I try to present a really good picture to what are the context of how this particular crime or this offense came into the court. Without that information, I think that it's hard to make a really, in my mind, a good decision, a thoughtful decision about how to proceed with these youth.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, not a question for the witness, but for Mr. Baucus. Can you just remind, we went through all the five different levels. This is the third degree, and it's the victim is 13 to 16, and there's 24 months difference, am I understanding that? And it's a felony, and it's, what is the length of sentence?
Mr. Baucus.
Madam Chair, if the it depends on the range again. As long as the offender's more than 24 months older, then that's when the crime kicks in. If the offender if the range is between 24 and 48, then it's a 5-year felony. Once it goes beyond 48 months, then it jumps up to a 15-year felony.
Madam Chair,
Senator Ortman,
it just occurred to me we've heard several instances of 24 months plus 2 weeks or 24 months plus 21 days. And I'm wondering if maybe a simple way to address this would be to adjust that difference to make it not 24 months but 36 months, where there's a three-year window, which in that age range seems to be maybe an easier way to address it than setting up all these new court procedures. I appreciate all the work that's gone into this bill. I just wonder if there isn't a more straightforward way to do it. And I'll just make that comment and for whatever it's worth. But I think this is an awful lot of process for the court that we might be able to really address in a more straightforward way.
Mr. Backus, what would be the implication of the 36-month suggestion that Senator Ortman has asked?
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, you know, you would have then, you know, fewer people committing the crime. I mean, you know, you would be basically for that extra 12 months, you would be saying that wouldn't be a crime under third degree. Now, what I was saying to you before, too, is that there is a little bit of an inconsistency for some reason between the third degree and the fourth degree law, in that the fourth degree law, in order for it to be a crime, and again, this is contact, the offender has to be more than 48 months older. So at some point, the legislature distinguished with that third degree that it's 24 months, and then they'd have kind of two penalties applicable, depending on the actual age range.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Mr. Backus, so this would leave it so that in the third degree, it would be, if we just took this out just a little bit further, it would be 36 months, would be up to a 5-year felony, and under the fourth degree, it would be a requirement of 48 months. Is that right?
Madam Chair, it depends on how you would want to do it, yes, but 48 months it has to be more than 48 months, I'm sorry, fourth degree. So third degree, for example, if you wanted to do what you're suggesting, you would have to decide whether you'd want to have maybe, you know, one crime, one penalty level for someone who's between 36 months and 48 months, and then another penalty level for someone who's more than 48 months, or you wanted to just eliminate that distinction within third degree and just have it apply to maybe more than 36 months or more than 48 months, whatever you saw fit.
So, I mean, the issue is the fourth and the fifth degree, and if we're tinkering with the third degree, then it affects all of that. So we'll take the testimony and noodle on that, because I think that's what Senator Dill is suggesting that we help him do, is to kind of think through that a little bit. But he does have the another component of it, which is the stay of adjudication piece of it. So, Senator Dill.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, there is a 60-month figure in this bill. And a very important element is to give the judge flexibility to consider various factors in the relationship, such as the whether it was consensual or not, or how does the parents feel about this relationship, what about cultural factors. And I think one of the things I'd really like to do is give the judge more flexibility in dealing with this situation. And Madam Chair, maybe we should move to Scott Engelston's testimony.
Let's do that, and then we can go into the details of the bill. Mr. Engelstad, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for hearing this bill, and for Senator Dill for sitting down with our committee out in McLeod County and hashing it out with us over the last couple of years. My name is Scott Eggleston. I worked in corrections for about the last 27 or 29 years. Tells you a little bit how old I am. I've been working with adolescent sex offenders since 1984. I have worked both correctionally and treatment. Essentially what I helped start this process about this bill through discussions with probation officers, because out in rural counties we're constantly catching kids in the 24-month rule. Essentially this bill is established in other states, and it's called a Romeo and Juliet clause, meaning that if an older, let's say a junior, is dating a ninth grader and there's a 36-month window, they aren't caught up in the greater net trying to catch someone who is breaking a law. You know, you heard stories about consequences and registration, and I mean, those are arguments I think that I love living in the state for, because we can debate those and look at returning somewhat. The adolescents have the right for poor judgment. not every kid who acts out sexually is a, quote, sex offender. That is a nomenclature that we apply to adults, and we have this tendency in my field, especially in psychology and addiction, to keep dropping adult models and laws down on adolescents. And adolescents don't even think like adults. They aren't even brain developed yet. Their frontal lobes aren't until about 16. So essentially, I think my support for this bill, and I also have talked, I'm on another group of about 40 different sex offender providers, if we want to call them that, from residential to POs to social workers to private therapists. And we were discussing this and how, anecdotally, how many kids they had that get caught up in the two-year age rule. And yes, it could be quicker, just changing the kind of, you know, the window of law there. And at the same time, I think, again, we run into some cultural issues and also maybe consensual issues. And I think there's a real important thing that in this law, when we talked to Senator Dill about, was that the judge can take into factors such as consent. And right now, even though it's there, there is a political, if you want to call it that, or a pressure, a public pressure, that sometimes I've talked to county attorneys who said, I really don't want to prosecute this, but I'm double-binded by the law. And to not do it, right, puts me in a position of I'm now supporting criminals, even though they're 15 or 17, and there's no history. And I think that if anything with this bill, I just am glad that it is presented to the state, is presented to your committee, and presented ultimately to the legislature to debate and to look at and say, okay, we can modify this. We can streamline it, make it better. I mean, that's what we've done over the years in my mind in terms of the state. So that's essentially my I agree with Michelle, and I definitely have many stories over the 20-some years of parents who've been caught in this trap. The criminal justice system is brutal in a way because it doesn't differentiate. Law isn't supposed to. But adolescents, again, I'm just going to say this, really are not adults. They can do horrible things. They can harm people incredibly. I think we need to return a little bit back to that thinking. It's way too easy to keep saying they should be responsible for themselves when their brain isn't even fully developed. So anyways, thank you very much for having me speak here, and to Steve, excuse me, Senator Dill, trying to respect you, to have me here at this table.
Any questions for these witnesses? We do have three people who are going to be testifying in opposition to the bill. So, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I have a couple. I would just say to Senator Dill that I can share your concern with how this well-intended maybe law initially has gotten to the point where it's catching people who really aren't the kind of people we would traditionally think of as being dangerous to society. I know I was just talking to someone in the Brainerd Public Defender's Office here a couple weeks ago, and she shared a very similar story with me of someone who had moved and then had to re-register and actually was going to have to go back to jail. She said for a year, this person was actually married to the person who had been the girl that he had been prosecuted for having the relationship with when she was younger. That just kind of defies common sense when you think about it. On the other hand, there's a couple of things with your bill that I'm having some difficulty with. One of them is the 60 months. You know, 36 months to me would be almost an automatic that I could support it. I could think about 48 months as maybe understandable. But by the time you're getting to a 20-year-old, I mean, 20-year-olds aren't generally going to be in high school anymore. I can't see a 20-year-old and a ninth grader, and I think it would be a lot easier bill to support if that were lowered from 60 months to, you know, maybe 48, if that would be something you could think about. The other problem I have is the part about considering the views of the family and even the complainant. You know, in some of the other kinds of things we have for protecting victims, we hate to put victims in the position of being pressured, you know, where there's potential for retaliation. And I also just see a huge warfare potentially developing between, of course, parents on both sides of this are obviously going to have their child's views. And I don't know if that's necessarily fair to the person. You know, what if you have a real supportive family in one situation and you have no family support for someone in another situation? Is that even potentially an equal protection issue? So it seems to me that I think your bill is on the right track, except I wouldn't make it quite that big an age group, but I don't know if it's fair to have the family views be determinative here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I believe the state of Indiana just went to the 48-month difference in age. At least they have a news release on that. So that would be something we could do. On the issue of how the parents of the children feel about it, I was told in the McLeod County Court one day there was a similar case where the parents were there to support their children, and they were all endorsing the relationship, and they didn't have any problem with it. And I just feel like the judge should be able to take that into consideration in deciding how to manage the case.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Dill. We're going to bring up the individuals who would like to testify in opposition to the bill, and then that will give us an opportunity for a discussion in the committee. Mr. John Kingry from the County Attorney Association, Ms. Carolyn Palmer from MCASA, and then Anne Marie O'Neill from the BCA. Mr. Kingry, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingry, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which in the past has reviewed various drafts of this bill in past years. But this bill being introduced today, we do not have a formal position on it. We have a policy committee that is going to be meeting tomorrow to review the bill, and we'll go through the process and continue to work with you on that. In many of my comments, and I'll be very quick, I know you have other agenda items, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, are more of the comments that I would make to you or the authors if we were meeting for the first time to discuss this bill. So I'm just going to raise some questions and ask for some clarifications that we can maybe meet later on. Also, as many of you know, we've had a bill in past years that would have addressed some of this, part of this issue with regard to registration. But it was deemed to be in violation of the Adam Walsh Act, so we regretfully had to pull that back. And it's our belief, based on the feedback that I received from several of our members, that this law may violate the Adam Walsh Act. And I think that's something that we need to look at. And so the question is, maybe it'd be better to wait and to ask for an extension to the Adam Walsh Act, which I know we've had some discussion on, or see if the Adam Walsh Act eventually gets modified so it's a little bit more workable, sensible, sane bill law. A couple of comments and questions. Since the individual, the offender in this case, is never adjudicated, would future, and I believe there's an amendment that would also put in fourth degree criminal sexual conduct. I'm not sure if that's been offered, but I know it's over there. So some of my comments are kind of having to be adjusted on the fly. But would future third criminal degree criminal sexual conduct cases still fall under this new provision when there's another offense here? Since this offense is not adjudicated, since it's dismissed, would future offenses fall under this? I mean, it's one thing to give an individual one chance with regard to a violation, but would a second and third violation still falling underneath this, would they sort of get another second, third free bite of the apple, if you will? Also, since this may involve juvenile records, and if an offender moves from county to county, going to a different school district or whatever, is my understanding that juvenile records are kept locally. We would have no way of knowing if there was a previous offense in this particular area, since we would have to survey all other 86 counties to determine that. So that's something that we need to look in, and we can discuss further. Under our licensing statutes, conduct that meets the definition of third-degree criminal sexual conduct is our grounds for permanent disqualification. I'm not saying whether it's a good policy or bad policy. I'm simply pointing that out to you. And even if a case is dismissed, access to the records is important without the necessity of seeking a court order. We're troubled by the word consensual. It's a word that's out there. I suspect it exists elsewhere in the statute, but there's really no good definition here, especially when you have the variance in ages that we're talking about here, potentially a very vulnerable victim here. And we need to talk about, and I know there's some discussion earlier about if the individual here, the offender, was in a position of authority. You get into whose word do you rely on and so forth. And the retroactivity, I think that's something that we're significantly troubled by. The look back in this bill, it goes back, you pick a number. It goes back as far as you want. I'm surprised the courts aren't here expressing their concern over that, because it could certainly open the floodgates for a variety of petitions for every defendant that's been convicted of statutory rape. The expungement laws should apply equally to all offenders, not create a special expungement category for this particular category of offender. And under 609A.02, subdivision 4, that prohibits expungement for an offense that would trigger registration. And so I think you need to look at these two together. With regard to stays of adjudication, that's currently available. We know that. It's been testified to. It was not used in this particular case, but that is available. With a stay of adjudication, prosecutors have an admission or a finding that the elements of the crime were proven, which may be helpful if the defendant later turns out to be a repeat offender. That's information that could be very helpful later on. If the look back is kept in and the dismissal language is there, I think at a minimum we need to have the words "without prejudice" added to it. We need to clarify that with regard to sexual predators, that those classes of cases don't fall within this, the ability to get those records without a court order. When looking at civil commitment for these particular classes of individuals, the Department of Corrections and prosecutors need that information, and I think it should be readily available to them without having to go seek a court order. The term "not public" indicates that it applies only to BCA files. It's not clear whether it would apply to court files or not, or individuals doing a pre-sentence investigation. That's information that they would need. And, you know, quite frankly, sort of the bottom line here is you're creating a whole new process, if you will, to basically lower the age of consent to 15. And I think this is a serious, significant policy discussion that we need to have. I'm glad that this has been brought to us, and I'm hoping between now and the next hearing that we can have further discussion on it. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Kingrey. I saw Senator Dill taking notes. I'm sure he's looking forward to working with you. Ms. Palmer?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Caroline Palmer, and I'm the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Our executive director, Donna Dunn, couldn't be here today because she's out of town, but we again thank you for providing us time on the agenda. VinCASA was founded in 1978 and currently provides technical assistance and support to over 70 sexual assault advocacy programs statewide. We collaborate with advocates, county attorneys, law enforcement, medical staff, social services, legal services, and many others to learn from one another and to work effectively together to change systems and policies to better meet the needs of sexual assault survivors. I would like to preface my comments by stating that VinCASA does not have a formal position on this bill. I am providing feedback from the members of our Access to Justice Subcommittee, which is part of our larger VinCASA Public Policy Committee. The members of the subcommittee are prosecutors from around the state who have a great deal of experience with sexual assault cases. I'm not a prosecutor, so we rely greatly on their insight as to how the criminal sexual conduct laws are carried out from day to day in the courtrooms. If there are any changes in the bill today, I will bring them back to that subcommittee to get further comment. And like Mr. Kingrey, I'm noting that there are some amendments, and so I'm going to kind of try to respond to those on the fly as well. Our initial concern was about the 60-month time frame difference. Under the current language in 609.344 subdivision 1D, as you noted, there are two key subdivisions, one for the complainants under age 13 with a defendant no more than 36 months or 3 years older, and a second for the complainants between ages 13 and 16 with a defendant more than 24 months, 2 years older. The proposed bill, if it doesn't set a threshold limit, which I understand there is amendment for age 15,
could potentially allow adult offenders who have no other regulated type of the relationship with a minor, such as a significant relationship, position of authority, or other relationship defined by statute, with a, quote, free pass to a sexual relationship with a child, such as an 18-year-old high school senior dating a 13-year-old, perhaps, if there wasn't the 15-year-old amendment put into place. One of our committee members pointed out this is of particular concern in some rural communities where some schools have all grades K through 12 in the same school. If the amendment goes to age 15, for example, and there's, a difference between a 15-year-old and a 20-year-old, we would still have some concerns about the large age differences. It raises questions for us about a young person's ability to consent as well as differences in development with regard to understanding sexuality. Teens develop at different rates depending on a wide variety of factors. Some teens may be particularly vulnerable to the attentions of a much older teen or young adult. This concern leads us to also ask why there's not an age cutoff for the offender, such as the offender not being over the age of 17 at the time of offense. With regards to the factors that the court will consider about whether to proceed with a diversion or dismissal, we do have some questions about how this information will be gathered. Will probation or the court gather this information? Will there be testimony? What consideration will be given to the complainant who may be facing pressure to say she consented even if she didn't? And further, how will this analysis be carried out in a fair manner from case to case in different circumstances that may exist? And again, taking into account the different developmental issues for both the complainant and the offender, which I think have been addressed well earlier. I also recognize that there may be a change with the amendment with regard to adding fourth-degree sexual conduct to the bill, and so I'll set that aside, recognizing that might be an amendment. My final piece is that we really find it difficult to consider this bill without talking about comprehensive sex education. MnCASA formally supports comprehensive sex education as part of its public policy agenda because we believe providing youth with information about healthy sexuality is an important tool for preventing sexual violence. Young people need accurate and timely information to help them understand what consent is and also what force and coercion are. Perhaps judges should consider sex education as a condition when appropriate in the cases covered by this bill. I do note in the bill that education about criminal sexual conduct laws is included, and that's a helpful step. But certainly we want to make sure that extra attention is being paid to the meaning of consent. So thank you again for the opportunity to provide these comments today and the opportunity to work with you on this bill. Our committee is certainly ready and willing to stand by to continue the conversation.
Thank you. And, there is a piece in here, though very narrowly, I believe this bill will, if it does pass this committee, it will have to go to the Education Policy Committee because there's a change in there. So.
Sex education.
Senator Betzel?
I've got a question, I guess, both for Ms. Palmer and probably Mr. Kingray. I see that in the upper left-hand corner of the bill, it's dated March 4th, 09, which would have been the date it left the revisor's office, I guess. That would have been yesterday, and it was just introduced today. So when did you have an opportunity to review this bill?
Mr. Kingry? Madam Chairman and Senator Betzold, I believe some of these bills are pre-filed, and all I know is I received a copy yesterday late morning and was able to shoot that past about five or six of my county attorneys.
Well, Madam Chair, and I don't know if it could have been pre-filed if it just left the revisor's office yesterday, so maybe there was a draft flying on. I'm just quite concerned that, I don't like the idea of some people carrying bills around too long, but on the other hand, if the affected groups haven't really had an opportunity to get the bill because it just got left the advisor's office yesterday and is in the news today, I think they're kind of at a disadvantage in trying to help us.
Yes. So Senator Betzel, Senator Dill and I have had that conversation, and for purposes of putting this bill on the agenda, we were trying to group all the children-related bills into this day. Senator Dill is very aware that the bill is very new and available to the public. It's our intention today to take testimonies for those in support of and those preliminarily in opposition to the bill so that Senator Dill will have a chance to hear comments. And then we will not vote on the bill today. And in fact, I think these are all very good preliminary comments, and Senator Dill will be working with the various groups on their input. That being said, though, we are facing deadline. This has to go through one other policy committee. Well, I don't know. I guess it's a finance committee now. So, so we're not voting on this today, but I felt it was important to take testimony so that Senator Dill knows who he needs to be working with.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just, I know I mentioned this already before, but I really, if we're going to be coming back to this again later, would really appreciate it whether Senate counsel or somebody could give us some legal advice. The part that has to do with taking into consideration the parents and cultural considerations, I can imagine why that's in there, and I think it's very well intended. And I think it's, you know, the cultural part of it is intended to be respectful of the fact that, you know, marriage and that, I mean, there is a cultural element to that that might differ from one culture to the other in terms of, in some situations, people form relationships at a younger age as compared to an older age, perhaps. But I also think that I don't know if there are any other examples where we would make different criminal laws or standards based on something that would be subject to either, you know, how a parent felt about something or even more broadly how a culture felt about something. And I really think that there's are potential equal protection challenges that you could raise under those circumstances. So that's a
legal Senator Olson, you can maybe visit with Senator Dill about that and talk to Mr. Backus on how to address that concern that you have.
And then one more concern, Madam Chair, that I would mention is I would think that we probably also would try to find some language so that this wasn't allowed to be, if we do expand the law, a repeat thing, you know, something where it would, if it was a second or a third time, that there wouldn't be some ability to have a record of that, from my perspective anyway.
We have one more testifier, and that's Ms. O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Anne Marie O'Neill. I am the supervisor at the BCA of the Predatory Offender Registration Unit. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today and just have a few very brief comments. I thought it would be important for the committee to have some statistics from our registration database regarding how many offenders this would actually impact in the registry today. And we also have had very limited time to review this bill. We started on this morning. So in that time, I was able to pull together a few statistics. Right now, there are 1,664 registered offenders in our database that have been convicted of criminal sexual conduct in the third degree, subdivision B. Of that 1,664, 365 of them had a 13-year-old victim, 620 of them had a 14-year-old victim, and 613 of them had a 15-year-old victim. We have another 66 offenders where the victim is just listed as under 16, so we don't have the exact age. But that just gives you an idea of the people that we're talking about. We also have an additional 213 offenders who've been convicted of this statute who've actually completed their registration period, but who are off the registry now but are potentially eligible to have their convictions vacated through the retroactive clause in this statute. We wanted to express our concern about there's not anything in the bill regarding how we should handle offenders who are statutory offenders from other states and how we would handle their registration requirements, knowing that they could not come to a Minnesota court and get their conviction vacated. And so that leaves BCA with some unanswered questions about how we should proceed with offenders like that if this bill is to pass. And we wanted to also make sure that the committee is aware that there would certainly be a fiscal impact to the BCA if this bill is passed. There would be quite a bit of computer and technology programming that would need to happen in regard to the criminal history to store these not public records. If the retroactivity piece stays in the bill and people start coming off the registry, certainly there will be a fiscal impact for unregistering people and then notifying law enforcement that they're no longer required to register. And then there will be the ongoing expense of the expungement of the records. So we just wanted to make sure that the committee was aware of that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Members, for purposes of discussion, I think there's an amendment in your packets that, let's see, I don't have a copy of it, but Ms. Backus, could you just briefly walk us through that amendment?
Madam Chair, members, it's the A1 amendment. I don't know if members have it handy, but it basically it just kind of it does two things. One is it makes this new state of adjudication provision applicable also for the fourth degree criminal sexual conduct crime, which is kind of parallel to this with the same victim, essentially the same age range of a victim. So it would apply to that as well. And then it would also require – it would also limit the stay to only situations where the victim was 15 years old at the time of the offense. So if it was a 13- or 14-year-old victim, it wouldn't apply, only a 15-year-old victim. And, of course, you'd still need that age range for it to be a crime.
So that's just being offered for your review as we move forward to think about it. Senator Olson has given a couple of comments on areas where she would like to see some work done, and I think she'll pursue that. I believe, Senator Ortman, you have an amendment that is coming. Do you want us to wait to see the language? We're not going to vote on anything today, so maybe you can talk about your amendment.
Madam Chair, I think what I'd like to do is I'd prefer to show it to Senator Dill first and review it with him and let him consider it, and maybe I wouldn't go forward with it if he opposed it.
Okay. So, Senator Dill, the amendment is being drafted, and once the language comes, we'll make it available to you. And for members of the public who would like to see all of this, we'll have it available in my office, and you can come and get the different pieces of the amendments. And then for members of the public who are not present here but who may be tracking us, I don't know, on audio or video, I don't know if the TVs are even on, but for your consideration, we are not taking the vote today. And if you have any inputs or any comments, I would encourage you to speak with Senator Dill about that. And then we will talk to Senator Dill about a time when we'll bring the bill back up for a vote. And for those who are here to testify in support of the bill, when the bill comes up, you're welcome to come back if you would like. Otherwise, have received your information, and we thank you for making the time to travel to the committee. So thank you all very much. Senator Dill, thank you for presenting the bill.
Madam Chair, members, thanks for taking so much committee time on this. I'd like to thank all the witnesses, both for and against the bill, and look forward to working with everybody and finding some compromise ground where we can get something passed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Dill. We were going to call Senator Pappas. So for those of you who are here to testify on my bills, I'll just have to ask you to be a little bit patient. If you're here to testify on Senator Pappas's bills, Senator Pappas's bill, let's see, is it Dr. Ellinger and Mr. Schlebeck, please come to the table. And Senator Pappas is on her way.
Schlebeck. Madam Chair?
Senator Pariseau?
The C is silent.
It's
a
silent.
Polish word, and it's Schlebeck.
Say it loudly so I can hear.
Schlebeck. The C is silent.
Klebeck.
You just.
Klebeck.
H. The H, yes.
Klebeck.
Cool. Yes.
Would you like me to?
The things you don't know.
Why do they have a C in the first place?
It's easier to, it's easier to pronounce than it looks.
Yes.
Why do they spell it? Klebeck.
Because it's a Polish word. You know,
because
why
we're
do you
being
spell your name
culturally
what it
respectful.
Is?
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and also thank you to you and your staff for assisting us and coming up with the A2 amendment.
Members, believe me, in packets, there's an A2 amendment that's being offered as an is being offered by Senator Pappas as an author's amendment.
No, Madam Chair.
Senator.
That we have also a first engrossment here, too, so this would not be the Committee of Origin. Is that correct?
It's not an author's name.
Oh, it's not.
Second committee.
Oh,
second committee.
Sorry. So my mistake.
So
well, then we will. Senator Pappas, why don't you present the bill? And then the amendment is before the committee. And as you present the bill, can you just talk about the amendment?
Talk about the amendment.
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, I think that I could make some opening comments about the health consequences for children exposed to secondhand smoke, which are very serious. At the Health Committee, we did have a video that we showed that talked about that. We have a young man here who would like to testify about his own issues with asthma. Just briefly, that this is a no-smoking bill in cars when children are present. It is only a secondary offense, and Minnesota will not be the first state to pass such a law. Arkansas, Louisiana, Maine, and California already have this type of law in place. It's been passed in the North Dakota Senate and will be heard in the House. Nine other states are also considering a similar ban. In many ways, this bill probably should have been passed before we did the smoking ban in restaurants and bars, because children, you have to admit, with their particular vulnerabilities to toxicity are especially vulnerable. And in cars, where the toxic level can be 10 times the level that the that is considered safe, this is really a very important area in which we should be regulating. So, but I have made some significant changes in the bill between the Health Committee and here, and I'll just walk through those on the A2 amendment. First of all, I've lowered the age to under 16 from 18. So if a child who is under the age of 16 is being transported, then a person may not smoke in a vehicle. I've changed the penalty to a petty misdemeanor with a $25 fine. That's on line 114. On line 115 and 116, I've indicated that this should not be a violation on the person's driving record. On line 117 and 18, we maintain that it is a secondary offense, not a primary offense. You have to be pulled over for a moving violation before you can be cited. The fine, and later on there is a surcharge, will be placed in the special revenue account and used for tobacco prevention grants, and we would hope they would especially target this money to educate parents that they shouldn't be smoking in cars with young children. On line 133 is the $25 surcharge, so the entire fine would be $50. And the effective date on 222 is August 1st, so that's the normal effective date. It's the same as in the bill. And on line 314, we indicate that the surcharge is also going into the same special revenue account. So, Madam Chair, would you be interested in hearing from my witness?
First, Senator Pappas, this is a delete everything amendment. The bill did come to us from the Health Committee. In your A2 amendment, are there any changes you're making here that would somehow make the Health Committee want us to send this back to them?
I don't know. I don't believe so, Madam Chair.
And in a way, the first bill that we heard in committee today really is a Health Committee bill that they sent to us. I think this bill went to the Health Committee for blessing on the fact that this was a health issue, but it really is a bill that's more for this committee. So they, I think, gave the concept their blessing and sent it to us. And I also don't believe that it has to go back, but if the Health Committee would like it back, perhaps if we've acted on this, and you may have to just talk to them, Senator
Right,
Pappas.
Madam Chair, I believe the only thing that they certainly would, it's your purview in terms of the fines and the petty misdemeanor. They just might be interested in the age change and the appropriation to the tobacco prevention grant. And in fact, I imagine that would require the bill to go to finance.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it would be the finance committee then that would be more concerned with that.
Right.
I'll have a conversation with Senator Marty, but I think he would probably agree that it's, if we could get it passed by lowering the age, that's a good compromise.
Right. Well, let's hear from your witnesses.
Okay, Dr. Ellinger is going to go first. He's from the University of Minnesota Health Center. What is it called?
Dr. Ellinger, welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Edward Ellinger. I am a pediatrician and director of Boynton Health Service at the University of Minnesota and president of the West Metro Medical Society, an organization representing over 4,000 physicians in the West Metro area. Recognizing that tobacco use is our number one public health problem and seeing the devastating physical and economic effects tobacco use and secondhand smoke have had on our society, physicians have been actively pursuing ways to reduce tobacco use and eliminate secondhand exposure for many years. Physicians have helped patients quit smoking. However, they recognize that there's a broader community effort needed to keep people from initiating smoking. That's why physicians have long supported statewide tobacco use prevention efforts. As data mount on the toxic effects of exposure to secondhand smoke, physicians have also increasingly recognized the public health importance of the state's Clean Indoor Air Act and the Freedom to Breathe Act. They have supported these efforts because they help protect the rights of everyone to be able to breathe clean and safe air, particularly those like workers in bars and restaurants who have no choice about the quality of the air that they breathe. The bill before you today supports that same philosophy, that everyone has the right to breathe clean air, particularly those who can't choose the quality of the air that they breathe. And what more captive and vulnerable population is there than children in automobiles? Because of their higher metabolic rate and where they sit in the automobile, children are the group most negatively affected by secondhand smoke in cars. And monitoring data have shown that the toxic chemicals from secondhand smoke in cars rise very rapidly to very dangerous levels and remain high even after smoking has ceased and whether or not the windows in the car are open or closed. So passing this bill would help eliminate this significant toxic chemical exposure for an extremely vulnerable population. But this bill would do even more than that. As a pediatrician, I see the influence that public policies have on the establishment of social norms that impact the cognitive, behavioral, and ethical development of children and young adults. Policies have a direct effect on individuals, but they also set the norms of behavior in our society that help educate children and young adults about what is appropriate behavior. This bill would help establish and solidify the norm that exposure to secondhand smoke is a significant public health risk. It would help teach children that they have some responsibility to help protect the health of their neighbors. It would help model the fact that people's actions have an impact on the broader society. This bill would also have an impact on the level of smoking in our society. Most smokers want to quit, adding another reinforcing message that their tobacco use not only affects them personally, but those around them will be another incentive to help smokers get closer to their goal of quitting. So as a pediatrician and a grandfather, I encourage you to pass this piece of legislation. It's good public health policy that will affect the health of vulnerable children and help improve the overall health of our state now and far into the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I also wanted to mention that under current law, the Freedom to Breathe Act, that does protect adults in cars if their car is either a work car or even if they're in their car for work purposes and there's someone else in the car with them, it does protect those adults. Now we have Mr. Joe Klebeck.
Mr. Klebeck, welcome to the committee.
My name is Joel Klebeck. I'm 11 years old, and I have asthma. I have to make a lot of sacrifices in order to keep my asthma under control. When I was younger, I had to take a lot of medicine. I wasn't allowed to go for recess when the air was bad. I couldn't go to birthday parties at homes, bowling alleys, or restaurants where smoking was allowed. Because of my sacrifices, I was able to stop taking medicine. A few years ago, my dad got remarried to someone who smokes. She doesn't smoke in a car, but she does smoke, or she does not smoke in the house, but she does smoke in the car. I really like seeing my dad, but I am tired of getting sick from breathing in stinky cigarettes. I have talked to my dad and his new wife about how secondhand smoke makes me sick, but they never believe me. I get terrible headaches, and sometimes breathing is really hard. After a weekend with my dad, I sometimes have a hard time at school because my head hurts and I don't feel good. I took a petition to my school and asked a lot of my friends if they supported smoke-free cars for kids, and 36 of my friends signed the petition. Adults should not have the right to do whatever they want around us kids. This law would help me and all other kids whose parents do not believe that their smoking hurts us. So please vote yes on smoke-free cars for kids.
Thank you. That was really great. Senator Pappas, do you have another testifier?
No, only if there's any questions for my other testifier. We do have some handouts. Do you want to pass these out, Jeannie?
Yeah. We can have somebody come and take them from you. Any questions for Senator Pappas or the witnesses? Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, if I may, and I'm trying to read the amendment. Did you adopt that right away? No, you haven't.
The amendment is the bill, Senator Scheid, because it's a delete everything amendment. So we're working from the amendment.
Okay. I have a question kind of based on what I'd read earlier. I understand it wouldn't be a primary
offense
violation, and so nobody would be stopped if police officers saw them smoking something in a car. I wondered, therefore, they're stopped for something else. What's the deal? How do you know somebody's been smoking?
Senator Pappas?
I believe the officer would have to observe them smoking or holding a cigarette.
A lit cigarette?
Holding a lit cigarette.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Scheid.
Excuse me.
And there'd have to be children in the car.
Yes, I understand there'd be, you know, may or may not be visible to the officer, so you know, at the time that they pull a car over. I certainly don't think adults should smoke in the car with children. I don't think adults should smoke in the car. I don't think adults should smoke, or anybody should. But
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, actually, my purpose here really isn't to catch parents. My purpose is really to educate parents. And sometimes, unfortunately, in our society, people don't do what's the best thing to do until there's a law. And even if it's a minor offense, a $25 or $50 fine, once people know it's the law, then they're more likely, I think, to follow it.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I understand that I had that bill that said you had to stay by the gas pump to pump the gas. And
otherwise it doesn't work, I guess.
and we passed that, and I was sorely embarrassed.
What year was that?
It was a year or two ago. I think a year ago I ruined a pair of shoes by flooding a whole driveway of a gas station once.
Well, in Minnesota, you know, that it takes a lot to stand by.
And heaven knows you wouldn't have wanted anybody smoking at that point. But I don't want to treat this lightly. I don't want to put children in the position of saying, well, my mom wasn't smoking, or, you know, I don't want police officers asking, well, was your mom smoking? I just wondered
Senator Scheid, in Subdivision 1, in the definition section, there's a reference to lighted cigar, cigarette pipe, or any other lighted tobacco or plant product. Mm-hmm. It also includes carrying a lighted cigar, lighted pipe, lighted cigarette, or any other lighted tobacco or plant product. So I think the way to read this is that when you get pulled over because you turned incorrectly, that the police officer comes up to you and you're holding the product that's lit. I mean, it has to be lit in the presence of the police officer. My presumption is, based on this definition, you can have an entire ashtray full of the stuff with the cigarette butts in there all out and about, but so long as it's not lit, you don't trigger the secondary, I think. That's the way that I'm reading the language in this bill.
Right, Madam Chair, there aren't going to be any breathalyzer tests.
Okay. However, if anybody has
Senator Pearsall?
A whole ashtray full of stuff when the child steps in and you start driving, you aren't going to be able to throw it out the window because that's littering. So you'll have to live with it in there until you stop the car again.
Senator Higgins?
I heard this bill in the healthcare committee, and afterwards I was thinking about how times have changed. And when I was a kid, when I was about...
You were a kid once?
I was a kid when I was about Mr. Hlebeck's age. My grandpa had a great big car. And so grandpa and grandma and my aunt and uncle and dad and my brother and me, we would all ride to church together in grandpa's giant car. My grandpa smoked, my dad smoked, and my uncle smoked cigars. And I always thought, you know, nobody in my church had to turn around and see that the Higginses arrived because they could smell us, you know, with all of the cigar and cigarette and everything. Now you just, I can't imagine a family doing that very much, but clearly some families still do smoke when their kids are in the cars. Sometimes I wonder how we ever made it to adults with all the weird things our parents did. Madam Chair, can
Maybe
I move the A2 amendment?
Senator Higgins has moved the A2 amendment.
I'm the only survivor, yeah.
Mr. Backus, under Senator Higgins' scenario, if this law was in effect and Senator Higgins' family was stopped because uncle was speeding, who would all get tickets?
Good question.
Madam Chair, if you look at line 1.11, the drivers would get a ticket if a passenger was smoking, and then the passenger who was smoking would also get a ticket.
would be an expensive day.
All the grown-ups in the car would get a ticket. Any further discussions on the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, Senator Murphy had a bill in here last week dealing with a different kind of smoking, and if there was doing that kind of smoking in the car, which would be perfectly legal if that bill were to pass, that would still be against the law.
Light it. Because not that they had the product in the vehicle with their eligible patient card, but if it was lit it, then they would be breaking the law.
So we open one door and close another.
English is my second language. I've told you that before.
I see.
Just trying to help.
And Higgins is still a kid.
Lifelong learning. It is very important. We say light it in this bill, in this amendment.
Light
it and lit. Okay, all right. I stand corrected. The A2, is there anybody in the audience here to testify against this bill? See none. On Senator Higgins' motion on the A2 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Higgins, would you like to move the bill?
I indeed would.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 359, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions? All those in favor? Yes. Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Oh. Let the record show that there are some noes, but the motion still prevails.
All right.
Thank you, Senator Pappas.
It's the story of my life.
Madam Chair, I'd like to take up Senate File 561.
Senate File 561, Juvenile Justice System Point of Contact Report Requirements.
And Madam Chair, I have the A1 amendment, which I would like to offer as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape I would like it to be in. And I believe that should be in your packets.
Okay, Senator Moi has offered the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form she'd like to have it considered. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 561 is an attempt to try to help the juvenile justice system collect uniform and accurate data with respect to the young people that are currently going through our juvenile justice system. If you look at the bill, it's the A1 amendment is basically, I believe, technical in nature. The most important thing about the A1 amendment that is different than the bill proposed is that on line 1.16 to line 1.7, I asked for the report that is coming back to be, as usual, electronically, and upon request, a printed version may be made available. But the essence of the bill is to defined specific actors in the decision-making process that come into contact with our children who are going through the juvenile justice system. We put in place some parameters for them to report back into a database, and then we ask the Commissioner of Public Safety to compile that data and that information and then make it available to the chairs and ranking members of the Senate and House committees having jurisdiction over juvenile justice policy. I have two individuals here who would like to testify on the bill and to help me answer questions on the bill. So my first testifier will be Judge Tanya Bransford.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come over and testify briefly about this bill. As you know, it is our shared goal that we treat everyone that comes into our courts with equity and fairness. We think that this bill will assist us in doing that by enabling us to collect the data that's necessary.
And Judge Bransford, I'm sorry, but just for the record, could you state your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. Judge, I'm not used to testifying in front of you all.
The roles are reversed.
They are. In my courtroom, my name's right there. It's the other way around. No, I'm Judge Tanya Bransford. Thank you. I'm a judge in the 4th Judicial District, currently assigned to the Juvenile Division. I am the assistant presiding judge in the Juvenile Division. I've been a judge since 1994. Prior to that, I was a juvenile court referee, so I've spent approximately the last 12 or so of the last 19 years specializing in juvenile court.
Thank you, Judge Bransford. Continue, please.
Thank you. The states are already required to collect and share racial and ethnic data through the requirements of the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. And that is one of the core requirements of the act to try to eliminate racial disparities. We need the data in order and at every decision-making point so that we can better enable us to make well-reasoned decisions, to identify the disparities, to better assist us in eliminating the disparities. However, one of the things that we also have discovered that we need is this bill would also add ethnicity, geography, and offense to what's already there. This will allow us to get accurate data to get a better picture of youth involved in the system at each and every step of the system. We want to make sure that we're no longer making decisions based upon people's guts or people's opinions or people's thoughts, but rather making decisions based upon evidence and based upon data to show what works and what doesn't work for our youth. We want to make sure that we are rehabilitating our youth, that we're getting them back to law-abiding behavior, that it's better for the society at large so that there's less offenses that are being committed. We think that it will get better outcomes for, as I said, youth and families. For instance, if we have this data, especially at every decision-making point, we can look at how we could better prevent youth from entering into the system in the first place. We realize that in this time of less resources, we want to make sure that we are using our limited resources in the most efficient and effective manner. Therefore, that is the real basis that we are requesting that we're speaking in favor of this bill. I could give a particular example of how we've already been able to use some of this data, if that would assist. Within Hennepin County, as you know, we have not only a large urban area with the city of Minneapolis, but also we go out as far as Corcoran and Hassan Township. When we were able to look and use some of this data, for instance, when we were looking at issues of young people with BB guns, we found out that if young people had BB guns in the city, they were more likely to be detained in a secure detention center, and that they were more likely children of color, African American and Hispanic. However, if the same young person was stopped with a BB gun, just say out in the rural or more suburban areas, and I don't know this particular area, but like Hassan Township or Corcoran or even Minnetonka or some of those other places that are, you know, suburban, we found out by looking at the data that those same persons were not being detained in secure detention. The other reason that we need geography is because if we find that there's a particular area where young people are committing the offenses, we want to make sure that the resources for them are in their area. I've had young people that I've had in court that we've said, well, they need to have their chemical dependency treatment or whatever. And I said, why aren't you going? And the parent said, well, we live in North Minneapolis, and the treatment program that we're supposed to go to is in Maplewood, and we have to take 3 buses to get there. By having geography, we can better identify and make sure that we're getting resources to the young people in their communities where they're needed.
Thank you, Judge Bransford. My next testifier is Professor Nakima Levy-Pounds, who is a professor at the St. Thomas Law School.
Welcome to the committee, Professor. Would you state your name for the record?
Yes, I'm Nakima Levy-Pounds, and I am a law professor, as Senator Moore said, from the University of St. Thomas School of Law. I direct a program there called the Community Justice Project. And through our program, we've been very actively engaged with this issue of juvenile justice reform. My scholarly research focuses on the impact of the war on drugs on poor communities of color and children. So what we're seeing are intersecting issues related to race, poverty, and the justice system. And so I know that here for this particular bill, we think that it's about data collection and public safety, and it is to some degree, but it is also about justice. The young man who testified earlier with Mayor Ryback said, when a young person makes a mistake, you intervene. And I agree with that. I would also add, you intervene, but not incarcerate unless it is a last resort. So with this particular bill, we would have an opportunity to ensure that it is a last resort when we are incarcerating young people, especially when you look at some of the disparities related to race and socioeconomic status. So, for example, in looking at the Cradle to Prison Pipeline report for the state of Minnesota, poverty is a huge factor for children entering the justice system. For African-American children, 3 in 7 were poor, compared to 1 in 14 white children and 1 in 4 Latino children. So we're seeing the way that poverty and race are intersecting to help create these disparities. And so we need collection of this data to ensure that at each decision-making point, that when children are entering the system, it's because they belong there, and not because of external factors that have to do with their socioeconomic status. And that includes all children, regardless of race, because the majority of children in our juvenile justice system are poor children whose families are living well below the poverty line. You also have about 85% of the children in the juvenile justice system are functionally illiterate. There are also quite a number of children who have mental health issues. And we're seeing schools funnel children through the pipeline to prison, to juvenile jail, because 25% of referrals into the juvenile justice system are coming from the public education system. And so there is a need for us as a leader in a number of different areas across the country to take action by collecting the data that is needed, again, to ensure that justice prevails for every child. And when we think about what justice means, we're calling our system the juvenile justice system. Well, when you think about the definition of justice, justice is generally understood to mean what is right, fair, appropriate, and deserved. So when we look at some of these disparities within our system, we have to ask ourselves, is justice really prevailing, especially for our young people, many of whom are voiceless, many of whom, as I said, have mental health issues, are living below the poverty line and can't even read. And in the state of Minnesota, I will tell you that we use third grade reading scores to predict the prison population 10 years from now. And that is pretty scary. For me as a parent of young children, I'm thinking that if my children make a mistake, rather than being given a second chance or being placed in a community alternative, that there's a jail cell waiting for them. So I think that we as a society and we as a community, a collective body of leaders, need to look really definitively at these issues and determine whether or not we are opening the door for a positive future for our children, or whether we're locking them into a system in which they cannot engage, that will result, based on research that I've done and anecdotal evidence, that will result in the creation and sustaining of a permanent underclass that impacts our workforce in the future. It will be difficult for us to compete in the way that we should be competing with all of the enterprise here in Minnesota. So again, this is an issue of justice. And we talk a lot about holding our children accountable. But with regard to this system and the rate in which our poor children are entering this system, we have to ask ourselves, are we holding our government entities accountable? Are we holding the stakeholders accountable? Are we holding key decision makers accountable? And if we cannot answer yes, then we need to move swiftly to ensure fairness and justice for these children. And I just want to leave you with a couple of, at least one quote by Mahatma Gandhi. He says, there's a higher court than courts of justice, and that is the court of conscience. It supersedes all other courts. So again, this is about justice for these children. Even in this budget year, we have to take action, because if we don't, then we know that more children will be funneled into the system, and one child lost is too many. So I just thank you for your time and your attention. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair and members, again, I just want to remind you that under the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, states are already required to collect and share racial and ethnic data with the U.S. Department of Justice, Justice Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency. And in fact, under the same federal act, we are required to create a plan to address any identified disparities. And so under this current requirement, Minnesota is already collecting much of this information. The problem is that because we haven't had an opportunity to weigh in, the information that's being collected county by county is lacking uniformity, it's usually not complete, and so when the information is being put together, we can't get any kind of meaningful results or meaningful analysis out of it. So the objective of this bill is to make sure that we help to collect information that would be meaningful in our analysis. And it would also serve the purpose of, continue to serve the purpose of reporting back to the feds. But that the information, while we're reporting back to feds, is also meaningful and useful for us here in the state as we look at our children who are in the juvenile justice system.
I'm sure.
Senator Bitzel?
I'm sure. On that point, Senator Moore, your bill provides that the information is to be provided to the Commissioner of Public Safety by January 15th, and then a summary of the data to be provided to the legislature by March 15th. Now, if this bill were in law today, that means that the data would come to us in about 10 days from now, which almost every given year is going to be, you know, right in the heart of the busiest time of the session. I'm just wondering what use the legislative committees are going to be able to make of this data when it comes at a time when we're probably pressing against deadlines to get bills out.
Senator Moore?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I'm aware of the date. My thinking behind that was that this was not the kind of information that, well, maybe it would, but I guess when I was looking at the bill, I didn't think that it would be the type of information that was necessarily carried with it specific recommendations, but it was more narrative and informative, an update on what the status is. And so the intent here is not necessarily, although it could, lead to legislative changes. I would think that it's, if in reviewing and the analysis of the information, if it entails that we act from a policy standpoint, my assumption is we would take the interim to do the kind of work, the analysis we need to, and then in the following legislative session, you know, do the bill work and the policy work. So that was sort of how I tracked the work process. Now, it's the will of the committee. If you think that there's a different, you know, we can put a different schedule to this, I'm more than open to that.
Well, ma'am, you mentioned some data being collected by the federal authorities, and I don't know how that would track or line up with this. I mean, it'd be kind of nice to have, if the data is being collected and being submitted, it all be done, you know, on the same schedule and not have differing schedules. But again, I mean, if for the legislative purposes, it's nice to get us in early in any given session. If there's any expectation, we're going to need it to make any change in the law. If that's not the purpose, I think sending it into mid-March of any given year is a odd idea, because that's the worst time of any legislative session. You might as well just send it to us in May or June or July or something like that then.
Senator Betzold, I've just been informed by one of the persons who's responsible for collecting the data that it's due into the federal government by March 31st of every year. So you would be getting it about 2 weeks before it would go to the federal feds anyway. That's the date that they apparently have established.
But then, Madam Chair and Judge Branford, is this the same information that is due to the Commissioner of Public Safety by January 15th?
Judge Branford or Senator Moy?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, the information would come to the Commissioner from the different counties. And then the Commissioner would take the information, do the compilation in preparation for the report, and it is the Commissioner's report that then gets sent off to the feds and that would get sent to us in summary form.
So is it thank you, Madam Chair. So it's the Commissioner that is going to be who is sending what to the by March 31st to the federal?
Commissioners.
So the Commissioner is going to – thank you, Madam Chair. So the Commissioner is getting the data by January 15th, and by March 31st submitting it to the federal authorities.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Well, if nothing else, Madam Chair, Senator Wong, then maybe you should just say March 31st, because if that's when they have to – I don't know what benefit it is to send the legislature 2 weeks before you send it out. If they're going to send it out, they might as well just send it out the same, you know, all at once rather than trying to meter it out and trying to remember all these different deadlines that they have to do. So
I'm certainly open to that date, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold, would you like to make –
I'll on page 2, line 25, change March 15 to March 31st. March 31.
Okay. Senator Betzold has offered that amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of anybody who would like to testify, anyone else who would like to testify on the bill.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on the bill?
Okay. I'd like to move that.
Senator Moy, I have a question for you.
I have a question,
too. Okay. Well, Senator Higgins, why don't you go ahead with your question?
Madam Chair, Senator Moy or Judge Bransford, you might know. It's nice to see you, by the way.
Good to see you too, Senator Higgins.
The risk assessment instrument and the database or whatever the data is to be transferred from the counties to the Commissioner of Public Safety, are either of those already developed, or is this going to have a fiscal note that includes developing those, the risk assessment instrument and the database?
Senator Moy?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, the risk assessment instrument bill is still in the committee. So this bill deals with just the database. And the database, we're not sure in terms of, I mean, this proposal for these different factors are certainly adding, we've added a couple of components to what the counties ought to already be collecting in compliance with the federal requirement. So it is, the bill will be on its way to the Finance Committee so that we can take the opportunity to look at if it's going to, because they're already doing it, adding a couple of factors is not going to incur additional cost, or if the counties are going to say it's going to incur additional costs. So we're sending this to Finance.
Senator Moy, actually, that was my question. I wanted to make sure, first of all, that we weren't going to duplicate, you know, that this wasn't going to be an extra report, that it was basically going to integrate with one they already have to do and maybe refine it and put some I think as your testifier said, some kind of a statewide standard for how this is reported,
right.
And hopefully not add any cost, but I guess that would be more of an issue for Finance then.
Right.
And then I think Professor Levy Pounds, did you have a comment as well?
Yes, I was just going to say that our office, in conjunction with a number of other stakeholders, have agreed to develop an instrument that will promote uniformity, so that we ensure that there's consistency in terms of the demographic data that's being collected.
Okay, then Senator Moy, you're ready to move your bill?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd like to move that Senate File 561 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Moy has recommended that Senate File 561 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you
to my testifiers.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like to now take up Senate File 415. And Madam Chair, Senate File 415 is a pretty small bill. I've asked Mr. Backus to help draft an amendment to just make it less cumbersome and to capture the gist of what it is that we're trying to do. You can see from the language of the bill, a couple years ago we dealt with internet or computer solicitation of children, and we put that into the law. And we're just trying to update that section of the law. Since that time, we found that there are other electronic things that are involved, and we just wanted to update the language of current law to be more inclusive. So, Mr. Backus, I didn't have a chance to look at the amendment after I asked you to draft it, but I'm assuming that it just cleans up the new language that's proposed under line 1.19 and 111, and it inserts the language on the A4 amendment. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A4 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape I would like it to be in.
On that motion, on the A4 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And on this new language change, I have Mr. Voigt from the AG's office here. If members have questions, he can answer questions.
Do any members have questions? I know I've already been briefed about this bill, so I think I don't have any questions. Does anyone have any questions about the bill or want to hear an explanation?
Just cleans up the language. Madam Chair, if there's Mr. Voigt, thank you for being prepared to answer questions. I'd like to move that Senate File 415 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Senator Moy, does this recognize any, could this trip into any freedom of speech issues?
Senator Moy?
Senator Limmer, I don't think so. I mean, Mr. Voigt, in your view of the A4 amendment, do you think it triggers any freedom of speech restrictions?
Mr. Voigt, would you state your name for the record, please?
My name is David Voigt. I'm a Deputy Attorney General. Madam Chair, Senator, we don't believe that it would raise any freedom of speech issues. There is nothing about the amendment to the statute that changes or regulates the content of speech. It simply extends the prohibition to a different medium.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Sir, if I could direct you to line 17 and 18, engaging in communication, and then it talks about relating to or describing sexual conduct. That seems to be different than with an intent to arouse sexual desire, or is it included in that? Is it the purpose of the bill to include that intent with that description of the new language on 17 and 18.
Mr. Voigt?
Oh, I see. They rewrote it.
Yeah, we just...
Okay, it's a rewrite.
It's a rewrite.
All right. Okay. So,
well, and Madam Chair, you know, we do have a lot of changing technology. You know, you have the new computer games, you know, the PS3, Xbox, and so forth, that you can play games and connect to the Internet. And I'm just wondering if you might end... You know, some of them are quite graphic and, you know, and violent and so forth, but you might have somebody, you know, who is 18 and playing, and there may be some, is it possible there could be some computer game that somebody who's 17 of an opposite sex, of the opposite sex, playing it, and it might be describing sexual conduct, in playing the game, and people can communicate with each other as they're playing these various computer games. Now, I don't know whether that, you know, would fall within the definition of an engaging communication with a child that the person reasonably believes is a child. And you may be describing, you know, some graphic things, but that may be part of, as I say, something that's, you know, part of a video game that they're doing. And I don't know whether this would well, as I say, as technology changes, we have to be aware of what's going on. So,
Senator Betzel, I would just ask you to, if you looked at line 1.12, that all of these things below here still have to be subject to being with the intent to arouse the sexual desire of a person. So, you know, at least there's that caveat, although I do know what you're talking about. In fact, I think even on Facebook, kids go on Facebook and then get into games and get connected through that kind of medium with all kinds of people now. I'm not even sure how it all exactly works. But, Mr. Voigt, have you given any consideration to that?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that the intent is to prevent the direct contact between an adult and a child in which the adult is engaged in grooming, engaged in sexual communications or perhaps the transmission of pornography, the kinds of things that we've seen on the internet. And the amendment, to my understanding, would prohibit that same kind of activity, that same kind of grooming activity on other mediums in addition to the prohibition of that grooming on the internet. The example, the internet gaming example, I don't know that the treatment of that would be any different under this amendment than it would be under current law, which prohibits the internet communication and solicitation of children for sexual purposes.
Well, Madam Chair, just earlier in this very committee hearing, we heard some testimony from, you know, some parents of young people that got caught up in the law, and you know, they wind up, you know, having to be, you know, they get branded because they you know, just because of the way it's applied to their particular situation. So, I think we ought to be careful to make sure we've thought of all the aspects here, and you know, the obvious ones are the ones that, you know, we sure want to stop, but we don't want to get somebody trapped into something else that might might come up, which is what we heard about earlier.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, the current law by adding the new method of technology doesn't change the underlying current law, which is applicable to a person 18 years of age or older who uses the internet. So, by expanding to other forms of technology, it would still be you would have to be 18 years of age or older who are using the computer or other forms of technology to groom and to engage in the kind of communication with the intent that's in the bill. So I understand your concern, but we're not changing anything that's in current law with respect to the requirement for the person to be the 18 years of age or older.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't have the answer right now, but that's why we wind up getting bills like we had earlier today from Senator Dill, when sometimes the current law, you know, is applied in ways we never intended. So I'm just advising, you know, the AG's office to be vigilant in this particular area, and if you see some problems that, you know, it's being applied in the wrong way, I think we ought to be notified of that. So thank you.
Will do. Madam Chair.
Senator Moore, I think the intent of your bill, the way I heard it described, was realizing that a lot of times people are now using their phones where they used to use their computers, and they get their internet on the phones, and just trying to expand the devices, but not really the way that they're being used is really no different, whether it's on a phone or a computer. So that's really almost like a separate issue from your bill, I would say, is just kind of looking at keeping on top of making sure we're not catching people in an unintended way, I suppose, is Senator Betzel's point.
Yep.
But are you ready to move your bill?
I'd like to renew my motion that Senate File 415, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
Senator Moore has moved Senate File 415 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the last bill on the agenda is Senate File 1059. Thank you, Mr. Voigt. Madam Chair, members, Senate File 1059 was, and I have two testifiers. I don't know if they're still here. I'd like them to come to the table. The bill is basically one sentence, and it states that it is the policy of the state of Minnesota to identify and eliminate barriers to racial, ethnic, and gender fairness within the criminal justice, juvenile justice, corrections, and judicial systems in support of the fundamental principle of fair and equitable treatment under law. And this statement, or this policy statement, would be placed at the beginning of the juvenile delinquency codes. And I have two individuals who will be testifying about why we would like to do this.
Madam Chair, committee, my name is Freddie Davis English, and I'm with the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee. I am the co-chair of our disproportionate minority contact committee for that, for that chair. Some of my history, I've worked for, I retired from Hennepin County after 35 years in community corrections, and I now am a professional volunteer. Points that we wanted to bring up. Minnesota has participated in the Juvenile Justice Delinquency and Prevention Act since it was first authorized in 1974. Over the years of participation, Minnesota has successfully implemented reforms in juvenile justice such as appropriate treatment of status offenders in non-secure programs and removal of juveniles from adult jails. In 1988, Congress added another very important core protection for our nation's youth. States must identify and address the disproportionate representation of minority youth within the juvenile justice system. Yet today, Minnesota still lacks a clear policy statement on this issue. This legislation provides that policy statement for all of Minnesota. Since 1988, other state agencies and the Minnesota Judicial Council have developed their own departmental and branch policies on this subject. Now, almost every department that involves youth has some iteration of the above policy, but they are all different. This legislation would bring all of Minnesota under one policy. This legislation is modeled on the Judicial Council policy on racial fairness, which has been in place for some time. It provides meaningful leadership in changing attitudes and the resultant subsequent actions. There is a great activity going on across the whole spectrum of juvenile justice, both within the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, which is appointed by the governor and serves to inform both the governor and the legislature on issues and trends in juvenile justice, and also in other collaborations where concerned Minnesota citizens realize that this lack of equality cannot be tolerated. Juvenile detention reform that identifies and addresses disproportionate minority contact, DMC, is currently in process in three metro counties. Recently, St. Louis County has also committed to detention reform. JJAC, Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, is also working with a coalition of counties in the 9th Judicial District and in conjunction with the Ojibwe Tribal Court of Leech Lake to implement reform that addresses DMC. This legislation will be demonstrable to the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention that the state of Minnesota is committed to working on the important core requirements of DMC. Now is the time for the state of Minnesota to add its voice and leadership by adopting this policy. Minnesota is at the top of the list of states with the greatest disparities between Caucasian and minority youth in juvenile custody, ratio 5-1 or higher. The rate of arrest for minority youth is 3 times higher than the rate of arrest for Caucasian youth, 2.5 times more likely to have their cases involve secure detention, and 2 times more likely to have their cases transferred to adult court than Caucasian youth. African-American youth account for 28.7% of juvenile arrests. They are 6% of the youth population. They are almost 5 times more likely to be arrested, 3 times more likely to be put in security detention, and 2 times more likely to have their cases transferred to adult court. American Indian youth account for 4.2% of juvenile arrest. They are 1% of the youth population. They are about 3 times more likely than Caucasian youth to be arrested, put in security detention, and have their cases transferred to adult court. Asian American youth account for 4% of juvenile arrests. They are 3% of the youth population. Caucasian youth account for 64.3% of juvenile arrests. They are 79% of the juvenile population. These resources are from the 2007 Minnesota Crime and Information. I can say that JJAC, Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, has worked with a number of committees and organizations across the state to ask for a policy, a unified policy on disproportionate minority contact.
And that is the bill.
Thank you, Senator Moore. Senator Limmer has a question.
Ms. Davis English?
Yes.
I had a question. This paragraph that's being proposed reminds me of a statement of intent or a finding that sometimes we consider in the legislature, but we rarely establish in our state statutes. And we let the statute itself speak for itself after considerable discussion. You raised a number of statistics reflecting a disproportionate record of arrests or convictions, especially of juvenile records. And I was wondering, how would, if this was passed into our statute books, I'm not sure if it's a law, it's a statement. So how would this statement alter the statistics that you offered?
Ms. Davis English?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. It would not alter the statistics. It's a policy statement to work from. What we've attempted to do is to address the issue since 1988 of disproportionate minority contact. And this would be a state policy that we are to address that.
I guess I'm confused, Madam Chair. I know we've had a number of reports. We've studied issues like this. I've been a part of being co-author of or chief author on a variety of things that study racial proportionment, abusive policies, references to potential discrimination in our court system that may be reflected by the court or by the enforcement mechanism of our judicial system. And after we study it carefully, then the study comes back to the legislature and we will, and commonly, rewrite our laws to reflect and try to perfect the administration of justice. But what I don't understand is usually a bill that we have would have an alteration to existing law, or we would consider adjusting a sentence, or perhaps the mechanism of what it takes to determine or to enhance a sentence, or perhaps we change the intent. Maybe the law isn't quite accurate in trying to get the goal. But I don't see, outside of this statement, I guess I'm troubled because we aren't going anywhere on the specifics of, is there a penalty, is there not a penalty, is there a malicious intent, is there malice aforethought, is there anything that puts and stitches this together in a motion that would lead us to a conclusion other than this general statement. And I We don't do this usually in state law, so I'm confused.
Senator Ma?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, you are absolutely right. That I think that as policymakers, we are often tend to be more reactive to the status quo once we have been told that something is not working. And I think that with this initiative that has been brought to us by the governor's advisory council, JJAC, it is an attempt to be more proactive in how we look at juvenile justice in these various systems. It is a different direction and a different approach. And I think that what this policy statement is asking us to do, and in essence, it is instructional for us in this committee, that as we consider policies, whether they're proposals to change, to add sentences, to change sentences, in the work that we do in the policy, that we measure it against this policy statement as part of our evaluative process in looking at the bills that come before us. So it is more proactive in that way, which is a little bit different, I think, from what we're used to in the work that we do around here.
Madam Chair, just one more. Madam Chair, Senator Ma, are you telling me that this would be, if established in law, that this would be the parameters of engagement whenever we deal with statute consideration, that first we'd have to look at this paragraph in our law and then justify our vote based on this statement of policy direction?
I would hope that it would include this, but of course would not be limited to this. This would be one of the factors that we would have to consider. But I don't think it would be limited to just this in our discussions.
Senator Betzel?
Well, I share some concerns about it, too. I mean, the legislature does set policy. We've got, I think, 23 volumes of statutes, and every one of them sets policy. That's what we do here. Now, to say that this is somehow going to guide us in the future, I don't think so. I mean, this is something that's going to be, if it's passed and signed into law, it's going to be put in the juvenile justice system chapter. I don't think we'll ever see it again unless it's in the intention, you know, to pass this out every time we take up any bills from now on and to point it out. I sure don't think that the proponents of this bill, you know, if this were to become law, you know, can justly go out and say, well, you know, we got a law to identify and eliminate barriers to racial, ethnic, and gender fairness in the criminal justice system and corrections, and we're supporting fundamental principle of fair and equitable. I mean, it doesn't say anything. It doesn't do anything. You know, and I'm really troubled at the idea of voting for. I mean, if somebody comes in with a bill that actually does things that are going to identify those barriers or to break down the barriers and so forth, then we've got something to talk about. But to pass a statement that does nothing just because we agree with the statement, I don't think it accomplishes anything. I don't think it sets any policy.
Well, Madam Chair, I certainly hear the concerns of the members of the committee. While I respectfully disagree, I think that having a statement like this in the law would certainly be helpful in guiding the work that we do. I understand the concerns that have been raised. And for purpose of the work that we do in this committee, I, for one, we'll continue to work from this perspective, and I'm going to keep the bill in the committee for us to consider, because as we move forward on the different bills that are going to come before us, I know that the good members of this committee will, of course, want to help us consider those proposals, obviously, from this viewpoint. And so I will lay the bill on the table for future consideration.
And Senator Moy, I would just make one more comment. And first, I also wanted to thank Ms. Davis English for the work she's done with Leech Lake, which is in my district, and I know is a concern there as well. And so thank you for that. And I was just going to make the comment that last session I carried a bill for the Indian Affairs Council that was different than this, but it had to do with recognizing tribal sovereignty, and it wasn't a bill, it was a resolution. And that this looks to me sort of like the kind of language that we put in that resolution, just in terms of setting a policy and making a statement about it. And so I would just throw that out there as, you know, another possible approach to this.
And we will do that, Madam Chair. You know, I did wonder if this bill would survive the Betzel test before coming into the committee. So thank you very much for your time. And now we're adding Senator Limmer as the aider and abater to Senator Betzel's Betzel test. Thank you very much for your time.
Madam Chair, you're going to separate us from
thank
now
you,
on?
The Judiciary Committee is adjourned.